Electric bicycles are my jam. I'm turning into a nut for a good e-bike. It's easy to get around, we save gas not driving our car for short trips to the store, and I'm getting a little extra exercise. The folks at Velotric are sponsoring a series of videos on my channel to show off some affordable e-bikes and help people get up to speed. It's easier than you think, and prices have never been more competitive. You can catch those videos on my YouTube channel, but if you're interested in shopping an e-bike, head over to velotric.bike/somegadgetguy and look at their road bikes and fat tires. Again, VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy. VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy. If any of those bikes look good to you, you can save an additional $60 off an already low price by using the coupon code SOMEGADGET60, SOMEGADGET60 at checkout. Once again, VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy and coupon code SOMEGADGET60, and I thank Velotric for being a sponsor on this show. Where's the button? This means we are live, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, tech fans of all shapes and sorts and sizes and persuasions. Welcome to another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SCGQA podcast channel. I'm Juan Carlos Bagnell, a.k.a. Some Gadget Guy, the SGG of this terribly named podcast series. But the QA, SGGQA... that's the important part. The question and answer is we have a bit more of an interactive conversation. I'm already seeing an incredible group of people chatting here in the live stream. Hold on, I want to kind of pull up my chat notes here. Let's run the list. I'm seeing Scoop, Copy Cash, Ron Guido, Ghost Starscream, got Barry Johnson, Brian Billing, Simon Says Hypno, Snorkel saying happy Monday. We got Michael Corcoran. We got a great crew already. This is why I like to kick off my show. Awesome Possum saying let's go, let's go, let's go. Why I like to kick off my show on a Monday. And hopefully folks remembered, I am being a terrible podcast host. Forgot to remind folks that it was daylight savings time, adjustment time here in North America. And we're still working on the legislation to abolish this horrific practice of moving the clocks around. Everyone in my family was up crazy early because we're used to being up at a certain time. And I felt bad for my daughter. She's probably going to have a miserable day at school all because of this arcane practice, which is really stupid. And we voted on the potential to examine the ramifications of abolishing the time change here in California. And I think we're just waiting on Washington State and Oregon. So I think all of the West Coast states are going to kind of in a block look at doing the same thing and just sort of joining Arizona and saying, oh, this is the time zone that we're in now. And that's always going to be the time zone and we'll never have to mess with these clocks and stuff. And Simon Says Hypno, yeah, you guys went back a couple weeks ago, and again, that just that cross communication. I probably should have like yesterday put out like I don't know a toot on Mastodon saying, hey, by the way, don't forget, guys, my show is gonna be at the same time, but not at the same time because time is stupid and humans are dumb. So I hope everybody had a lovely weekend. We took this weekend pretty chill. Just over all of the festivities from Halloween, the big event this weekend is the kids at my daughter's school worked really hard on putting together displays for a Dia de los Muertos celebration. So there was this like party that at my daughter's school. And I still need to get in touch with the PTA. Just for her, I shot just like some video clips. It was really cute because the school hired mariachi and they had like a little taco stand set up and all kinds of like pastries and desserts and things. But the kids themselves, each class made like a little display. And you could see like the kids were so proud of the work that they had done. And then the school put it together in a really lovely way. So right now on the Patreon, you can see sort of the little video that I cribbed. And it's not some grand piece of cinema. We're talking like basically one of Juan's like family home movies here. But it was all shot and edited on the Pixel 8 Pro. So as just sort of a practical test of what I've always been preaching, this is the kind of thing that I love to show off is you you shoot a bunch of little clips of like a family gathering, and then you can just stitch them together. And instead of making people watch these individual clips, you can just have like a little minute of remembering what that event was like. So for, oops, not my intro, let's go to the web browser. So I wanted to show just a little bit here. I'm going to mute this because I'm not entirely sure. What I used is the mariachi music from the show. So from the party. So I'm going to mute that just in case there's any copyright. But they were just really so proud of putting together presentations on famous Hispanics and Latinos. And then there were these little mariachi. So I shot video of an entire song of them playing. They had they made these little sort of modular ofrendas so that, you know, you could kind of remember people in your family that had passed. It was just a really lovely event all around. And it was a fun way to kind of practically test, because all of this is super, super dark. So you walk into the school's like performance arts center. I think they call it the performance media center or something like that. And it was super, super dark, and everything was lit by candlelight. Papeles picados are all over like the walls and things. It was just a really, really cool. I wanted to get, yeah, there was this full altar setup that, this was super dark, by the way. So the pixel is actually getting taxed pretty heavy to shoot that. So it was just really lovely. And so if you're on the Patreon, you can kind of get a better look at that in the full 4K. And I'll share it with the PTA, and hopefully they dig it. But the rest of our weekend was really, really chill. I spent longer than I probably should have replacing a shower head in our bathroom. Like, we've been living in this place for a while, and we still have things that are just like, ugh, we'll get around to it. And just for whatever reason, I got annoyed. And just like, it's so gross, we've tried cleaning it out, we just gotta replace this stupid shower head. And I was one of those like handyman, like I get to break out the real man toolbox, not my set of crazy screwdrivers to take apart a motherboard. No, I'm taking pipes and moving things and tightening this, and oh, I gotta get some Teflon tape. So it was pretty silly. But I hope you all had a lovely weekend. So, oh no, Dave Burns. Hey nerds, I'm trapped in IT hell. Hope you have a good, hope you had a good holiday, Juan. Well, thank you, Dave. I appreciate that. JMN150, yeah, hope everyone has been enjoying the start of the month, and hope everyone has been having lots of fun. And we're getting into that, like, holiday buying season. How are people feeling in the chat? I usually don't do a whole bunch of gift guides, but if I see a great sale, I used to tweet it. I don't want to keep supporting the Twitter, and it just seems weird, like, packing a whole bunch of affiliate links into something like Mastodon, where it's, like, you know, it's owned and operated by someone paying for a server, right? It's a community server. So I tend not to affiliate link spam on something like Mastodon. Is Threads the place to go? Like, if we see a really, really cool sale, do I put the link there on Threads? I'm really kind of not sure what to do with some of this. But I'm also curious in the chat. To me, I'm getting the feeling that this is not going to be a heavy tech buying holiday season. What are some of the feelings that you're getting with your family and friends? Like, I'm leading up into Thanksgiving, and everyone in my family is talking about travel. They're talking about vacations. They're talking about experiences. One of the requests from one of my siblings is gift cards to restaurants instead of gifts and things that they will just sort of own. So to me, I feel like that's kind of the vibe in the air in my circles that I'm kind of experiencing right now. Simon says it, no. Home ownership is a series of DIY procrastinations. So I don't, this is so much TMI. Like, the shower head was fine. I didn't like the pressure. It was from the previous occupants of this place, which is just kind of gross when you think about it. But there was like a little crack, and you would turn on the shower head, and one little jet of water would spray off the side of the shower head. And I finally just went, no, I can no longer stand this this issue. And I went to the little DIY, and I got a new shower head and put it on there. And It was fine. I mean, it's like, it's again, it's one of those things, like, it really didn't take me that long, even though I'm not the handiest guy. But it did take me a while to figure out, like, the tension on the little swivel connector, because, like, not enough tension, and it just, like, blobs water out the sides. But too much tension, and then you can't turn it. If there's too much tension on the swivel connector, it doesn't swivel, and when you try to swivel it, it starts to unscrew from the shower head. So it took me, like, it probably took me an hour of, like, nope, too tight, nope, too loose, Which, like, you should be able to hand tension this stuff and just be like, done. So anyway, you guys don't need to go through all that. Steve Pogue, I know what to get for a few of my family members, but I'm clueless on most of my fun family. None of it is tech, though. I'm getting that vibe. I really am. Oh, Dave Burns, I'm looking at buying clothes that will last longer and thrifting older clothes that are better quality. I think that's a great plan. And also, I'm going to need some help because especially like getting through Thanksgiving, usually I recommend people contribute if you have the means, if you know, because times are tough during the holidays for everybody. But if you have that little bit of extra that you can give, looking up local food banks. Those are always sort of like some of my go-to charities. There are a couple other organizations that I want to look at this year, and I want to start reaching out to maybe some school or educational opportunities for those of us who maybe have some old tech. I've got like a little mini PC that I'm definitely not going to do anything with, and it could go to a school. Like that could be an administrator's machine. It's not crazy powerful. They don't care. They just need stuff like that. So, That's also going to be, I think, especially into next week's podcast when I've had some time to do a little bit of extra investigation. We can chat a little bit more about that too. Oh no, Bryant Billing! I didn't hear about this. I had a week filled with many inconveniences that accumulated to cause a lot of stress. I'm sorry to hear that. Did anyone else get screwed by Chipotle's burrito Halloween ordeal that crashed their app? I have not done the Chipotle thing. Oh my gosh. So Chipotle always does silly Halloween things. I think the last time we did one was 10 years ago. And the whole thing was like, if you go to Chipotle dressed up like a burrito, you get a free burrito. And it was a really silly Halloween thing that a bunch of us got together and a group of us who didn't have kids. And we took it seriously. A friend of ours got like the industrial sheet rolls of tinfoil from like a Costco, and we wrapped all the way up, and it was horrifically uncomfortable. It like you're just insulated in tinfoil. We're sweating buckets. We walk in, and they're taking anyone who just has any kind of tinfoil stuck to them. And the line is crazy long because everyone's there for a free burrito. And we're the only ones that are like decked out in tinfoil. I have not done a Chipotle Halloween event. It's probably been a decade. That is insane to me. That just hurt my brain so much. Simon says, Hypno, I already got my folks their Christmas presents, Pixel 7 and Moto G54. So they can have a pillow each come Christmas Day. I love it. See, that one's kind of cool. Like, if you know you can kind of sneak someone in. I'm still struggling what to do for my uncle. We were really looking Xperia 5 Mark V, and they're not officially shipping or selling to the United States, and he does not want a bigger phone, but he wants expandable storage. And there is nothing left. So we're looking at Asus and maybe just buying way higher than he needs to get the larger storage there. But we also might go Pixel 8 and just call it and just say, hey, it's time. Unfortunately, there's just not enough that we can... we can't vote with our wallets. And that's the thing that's killing me. Is you say, like, oh, you should support this and you should vote with your wallet. And then you're like, yeah, but there's not. So, let me get this out of the way. Oh, Gormlord. Yes, completely agree. Inflation has hit hard this year, so gift giving is going to have to be on the cheaper side. Haha. I think it is always worth, especially for your extended family, reaching out to family and friends and saying something like, I would like to recommend a Secret Santa. We do this with all the cousins on my dad's side of the family, where someone has to organize it, and that is a thankless job. But someone says, like, hey, I'll organize a random draw, and you're assigned one of the cousins, and you're only responsible for kind of like gifting that one gift. The other thing that works so well is also recommending something like, hey, this year for the holiday at the end of the year that we all celebrate, whatever holiday that might be, can we do a photo exchange? Take like some of your favorite photos of the year and print them out in little 5x7s, and can you send me photos? And I'll send you some photos of what I thought were some of the, like, there are ways to kind of get creative. And if you go to like a photo printing service, boy howdy, little photo prints, 5x7s, those are stupid cheap, but they're these physical things that people like, they like really kind of glow over. It's like you took the time to print me a photo. It's like, I made this for you, and I made it. I didn't just like Photoshop some stuff and send you a link to an image that you view on your computer. Like, as an inexpensive gift, a very inexpensive Target picture frame and a print. If you want to get fancy, put that together. Or if you can spend like the $10, go and print. Like, our smartphone photos even look good out to like 11x17. They can get a little grainy or stretched, but that actually kind of adds to the sort of charm of it being a printed photo. So stuff like that. Like, it shows that you thought of them. It shows that you put in effort, and it's still a meaningful gift without it breaking the bank. Oh, T-Bubs, that's cool. Can you tell me what you use? T-Bubs says, we found an online version for doing a Secret Santa with my wife's side of the family. I'm excited for it. Let me know what you're using, because we just, on my dad's family, we just did it manually. So it's all going through, like, email. But if there's, like, a way that you can make it a cute little app, and then people can get even more excited about something like that, that'd be really cool. So why don't we knock out some housekeeping? I'm going to take a little drink of coffee here. And we've got a pretty decently meaty news block to get through. And then we got to talk the big excitement. MediaTek announcing their new chip. And I'm not going to make a regular habit of doing this on the podcast, but I so rarely talk about gaming. I just have a lot of thoughts about the new RoboCop game. I want to spend a little time kind of chatting out some of that stuff too. So drink a coffee. We'll knock out this housekeeping and we'll get into this news blog. Let's go, let's go, let's go. Yeah, awesome possum. It's meaty. And again, it doesn't work at all with Restream. T-Bub says Elfster. All right, I'm going to check out Elfster. This podcast is not sponsored by Elfster. I have no idea if it's like ripping off your personal info, but it comes highly recommended from T-Bubs. So I'm going to give it a look too and see if it's something that we can use in our family shenanigans also. Okay, one second here. Hold on. Okay, going into the screen share. Had a couple busy weeks. So last week was a pajama podcast. We didn't do a super deep dive on the housekeeping, but I finally got my video out on the Pauly Voyager Free 60 Plus UC. The total package work and play true wireless earbuds ? A really interesting sort of business grade solution for portable audio with some little tricks built in that I thought were really interesting. These are very expensive earbuds, but they do things that I don't know that I've ever seen on any other set of earbuds. Then also last week was a big week for both my channel and TK Bay's channel. So we did another cross-channel collaboration looking at folding phones. On my channel, we're chatting OnePlus Open versus Galaxy Z Fold 5. Because TK has spent a little bit more time with the Z Fold, he came over to my channel to share just some of those thoughts, some of those comparison points. So it's really me interviewing him. And then on his channel, he was asking me more about the Pixel Fold versus the OnePlus Open. And we also mix in a little Duo commentary too, because I'm a big old Duo nerd. So there are two parts to this conversation that seems to confuse and enrage a lot of YouTube commenters. Like, I got another comment this morning, like, you guys didn't even mention the Pixel Fold. And you're like, there's a whole 30-minute video that's focused on that. You're really bad at the listening comprehension. It's like I'm now starting to grade YouTube comments. Like, your grammar is terrible. Your comprehension levels are shockingly low. I'm amazed you can operate a computer keyboard, let alone find your way to this video on the internet to leave this comment that you've left. That actually shows a surprising amount of tech familiarity for you to be this bad at leaving comments on YouTube videos. Also, just kind of quickly wrapping all this up, I did do a little cutout. So Flowtech Wolf asked a fantastic question on the podcast 2 weeks ago. And last week I cut out the question, what is the right age to give a kid their first smartphone? And just made it its own little standalone video clip. And I gotta say, it's been generating some interesting conversations. And again, you can very quickly see the people who are knee-jerk reacting just to the title of the video. And then there are a lot of people that are watching it and going, oh, I hadn't thought of that. Or, hey, that's a great point, but you should really consider this. And that's the kind of stuff that I glow over. Because when people bring up things like, oh, you missed this idea, or there was another potential outcome, or this is a way that we keep our kids safe, it's that sharing. Because there are a bunch of hot take knee jerks like, oh, you should never get, certain smartphones are toxic. And you're like, great, but that doesn't help answer the question. So expanding on that, what do you think would make this situation better? Especially owing to the reality of owning a piece of telecommunications equipment in the 21st century. And then I just want to really quickly revisit the Patreon. We showed a couple little clips, but there's the Dia de los Muertos shot and edited on the Pixel 8 Pro, so you can catch that. And then in early preview right now is my review on the Ace PC Wizbox G. And I am super stoked about this little mini PC. It's rocking the Ryzen 7735HS. It's got a Radeon 680M. It's built to look like a little mini gaming PC with all the RGBs. Obviously, a lot of these little mini PCs are just using like laptop style components. But this one is one of the first that I felt really does a good job of living up to the idea of maybe being a gaming-focused mini system and at a shockingly low price. So that's in early access right now on the Patreon. I think it's going to go live tomorrow or Wednesday publicly. But if you want to watch it right now, you can watch it right now, patreon.com/somegadgetguy. So why don't we shift gears, knock out some news, and then we can save like some fun gadget and tech conversation for the second half of the podcast, especially if folks have any questions about stuff that's been released. I really want to spend some time talking about Dimensity. I know I keep saying I want to spend some time talking about Dimensity, but they sent me one. So here's a little Dimensity 9300 in clear plastic acrylic. So, you know, I've been benchmarking the chip. I got it all soldered into a logic board and I'm running it and doing... Nah, I'm not doing any of that. That's silly. Well, I gotta drink some more coffee. I'm only moderately caffeinated. This is the best. Oh, Brian Billing. Yeah, the Ace PC. I have yet to watch that one on the Ace. It looks awesome. I am so stoked about these little mini PCs. I'm putting together a video on, I'm gonna call it the laziest way to upgrade your NAS. Because I just set this up last week, and I'm kind of running it, testing it, and trying to optimize it a little bit better, but my NAS doesn't do hardware encoding. So if I just send out 4K video streams, it's really capable. But if I'm out mobile, and I'm using cell phone data, and I want to turn one of my 4K Blu-ray rips into a 720p stream, boy howdy, does that little NAS chip not want to do that at all. It just like pins like complete total CPU utilization. It's like cooking my NAS trying to do that. So I've got like a couple little mini PCs here. What if I just used that as a front end? So if you just threw money at the problem of hardware transcoding, you could totally do that. Simon says Hypno. No, I can't. All right, hold on. We got to do this. Does that Dimensity feel good in the hand? You know, it feels like a good chip. It's a little big. You know, some chips are smaller and some chips are bigger. And so, like, if you've got small hands and you're trying to just hold the 9300, it's got, like, sharp little pokey sides. Like, I'm using it in a protective case. But if you use your chips naked without a case and you put it in there, like, I don't know that you would want to do that because it's got, like the bezels are sharp and pointy. So it kind of, like pokes you in the hand, and that wouldn't feel very good in the hand. It's almost like it wasn't designed to be used exclusively by evolved primates with opposable thumbs outside of some type of other contraption or gadget. But if you wanted to use it all by yourself, I mean, you could use it that way, but it sorry, I'm gonna stop that right now. Oh, Steve Pogue, that's a great use. Speaking of mini PCs, my school's gaming club is using a Minisform UM773 Lite for emulating older games. Heck yeah. Easily, and like, what, anything that's rocking like maybe a 3 or 4 generation old Core i5. Like, I've got a, what is it, the Geekom IT8 uses an 8th gen Core i5. Plenty capable up through recent arcade-y style games. Like, you could, if you kick down to 720p, you can still play Tetris Effect on an 8th gen Core i5. It does not take a lot of horsepower to have a really solid classic arcade gaming experience. Yeah, Gormlord. I haven't watched the video yet, but this is kind of what I want to piggyback on as a part of this conversation. Speaking of NAS, Explaining Computers just put out a video about making a NAS from a mini PC. Very handy info. So I'm not going to do a full NAS, but I do want to look at a file server project and a photo backup project. But the first thing I want to do is just literally, I'm using a mini PC as a new front end system for managing my media. And I got to tell you, you know what? I'm going to get into the news. I'm just having fun with this, so I kind of want to spoil it right now. This is going to be a separate video. It'll have better B-roll and stuff, but I kind of want to show this now. What I have is a Geekom Mini Air 11. This is an 11th gen Celeron. This is not a computer that's going to, like, rock your socks. This is a very low-cost, practical, low power system. It's going to be great for, I've done a couple reviews on similarly spec little mini boxes like this. But I picked this because it's, well, first of all, it's crazy low power. It idles at like 8 watts, and peak CPU utilization, I don't think it breaks 30 watts. So assuming California energy prices at peak energy usage, so I think we're roughly 40 cents a kilowatt. Like, it's pretty bad here in Southern California. But if I ran this at peak CPU utilization for a year, 24/7, 365, it would add about $160 to our yearly energy bill. So that's money to take into consideration, but we also know it's not going to be used that way. So what's kind of exciting is I've got this little Celeron. It's connected to my network. I'm running Plex from this, and the Plex is looking for the storage on my NAS. So all of the files still live on my NAS. But I bought my NAS for video editing. So that's why I went 10 gig. You don't need to do all that. I'm editing 4K video, and I want it all on a server that I can access quickly from my desktop. Not many of my video files live on my workstation. Now that we've started using services like Plex a little bit more, my wife has occasionally, like, on a trip gone, oh, well, I just want to watch this thing, but I'm on cell phone data. If it's the full quality of that, one, it's not going to stream anyway, and two, it's going to nuke our Mint mobile plans. So if I'm trying to edit video and she's trying to stream and transcode, both of our experiences are terrible. But now all my NAS has to do is send video signals out, which the NAS does really, really well. And then when she is streaming off of the Plex, this is doing all of the transcoding. Now, is this as fast or as exciting as like a beefier mini PC with a better dedicated integrated GPU? Not at all. There's definitely lag getting a 720p stream out. But my experience trying to edit video from the NAS is not impacted at all. I go from pinned 100% CPU utilization to software transcode to like 3% CPU utilization just to send the stream to this box, which then you can hear the little fan kick on. It is so quiet. These little Celeron chips, not exciting computers, but it is exciting that they are quiet and they are sipping energy compared to like a more fully featured x86 system. So I'm sure the video from Explaining Computers is going to be a lot more exciting for putting together a full system NAS, probably using something like TrueNAS, getting a RAID array, how do you put all these drives together, all that stuff. But I'm literally just looking at a plug-and-play solution where I just put compute power in front of my NAS and it has freed up the box with the hard drives to do what it does really well. That to me is, it's like a fun, like this is so much cheaper than if I had had to buy a new enclosure for my NAS to get hardware video transcoding. And even then, my NAS would not be working as hard when I'm using it and my wife is using it at the same time. So that to me is a better division of labor than spending more money on a different NAS enclosure. And then there are other things that I'll be able to do with this too, like if I want to set up something like a front end for a Google Photos replacement. And that can also run off of something like this. Okay, whew. Video coming soon. I know. It's one of those things, like when you kind of figure out something new or you make a little discovery like that, it's like, oh, I want to tell a bunch of people. I don't know about you, but I have a lot of people in my circles of family and friends that really get interested about stuff like that. So unfortunately, you guys just have to deal with it on the podcast. I just spilled water all over my mic. Awesome. All right. And yeah, Brian Billing, the new Radeon 680M is a beast for such an inexpensive system. It really is shockingly good. Let's knock out some news. I don't want to get too deep or too dark on any of these stories. And for some of these, I'm actually going to point to some other resources too. Like this first story, written up by my man crush, John Brodkin, over at Ars Technica. Get this out of the way there. Guilty, Sam Bankman-Fried convicted on all counts after month-long trial. Bankman-Fried convicted on 7 charges faces maximum sentence of 110 years. From the article, FTX founder Sam Bankman-Fried was convicted of defrauding customers by a federal jury today. He was convicted on all 7 counts. Reuters and other news outlets reported the 12-member jury returned the verdict after several hours of deliberation. 7 charges are wire fraud on customers of FTX, conspiracy to commit wire fraud on customers of FTX, wire fraud on lenders to Alameda Research, conspiracy to commit wire fraud on lenders to Alameda Research, conspiracy to commit securities fraud on investors, conspiracy to commit commodities fraud on customers of FTX in connection with purchases and sales of cryptocurrencies and swaps, and conspiracy to commit money laundering. Those last ones are kind of important. If you're not super deep into crypto, I have to throw a shout out to Trev on the Discord. He hooked me up with, already forgotten the name. I'm going to have to link this in the show notes. Pulling up the podcast now. Where are my subscriptions? Against the Rules with Michael Lewis. So Michael Lewis has been on a book tour sort of pitching his book about Sam Bankman-Fried on top of the news sort of following the trial of Sam Bankman-Fried. And so that podcast has been sort of a daily look at the ins and outs of the legal procedure, of the courtroom drama, of the of some of the shenanigans, the back and forth between the defense and the prosecution, with some really good commentary. And each episode is kind of packed with ads. If you're just listening to the free, like, there's a paid subscription for the podcasting network that they're on if you want to listen without ads. But each episode is like between 10 and 30 minutes. And it's really been a good look at what exactly are the nuances in this, because we can get caught up in the tech. Sam Bankman-Fried is one of those people who seems really good at explaining all of the exciting things that tech can do. And that's how he gets people, interested in doing business with him and using these exchanges and getting involved in cryptocurrencies. That's pretty easy. I get really excited about tech, and we can have conversations about ridiculous gadgets that you probably don't need to own, but you would have a lot of fun with. I'm kind of an enabler that way. But one of the things that's been really interesting is watching, especially how the judge has informed part of the conversation about what the potential crimes were. And now he's been convicted of all seven of these crimes. It wasn't so much he stole money from people and spent it. It was he was gambling with other people's money in ways that they weren't aware of or they wouldn't have condoned. And that, to me, is one of the killer things that hopefully this is going to set even stricter precedent for future potential abuses. Like, this is the kind of trial where we should have seen some bankers go down for the housing bubble crisis back in 2007, 2008. More bankers should have gone to jail after that. But if we can make kind of consistent, pleas, it's not, oh, someone stole money. You steal my wallet, you understand that crime. If you take money from me and you tell me you're going to do something with that money and then you do something different with that money, it kind of doesn't matter if your gamble pays off. It only matters that you did what you said you were going to do with the money that I gave you. And I feel like that is one of the major issues at play with Sam Bankman-Fried's trial here. He was very risk positive. If there was any potential for a big payday, payout, something exciting that could happen with the way that he was managing these funds, he seemed game to gamble with other people's money. When we're talking about billions of dollars, a lot of people get real upset about stuff like that. So the Michael Lewis podcast, I would highly recommend giving it a listen, in addition to reading John Brodkin's write-up, because a lot of this stuff is condensed in Brodkin's write-up about how the jury deliberations went down and some of the commentary surrounding the particulars of the trial. But if you really want to get a better understanding of why we went after Sam Bankman-Fried the way we did and why it's sort of occupied as much of the media coverage, it's like, this has been a really interesting trial to follow, and there's been a lot of follow-up on it, then I would recommend the Michael Lewis podcast too. Dave Burns, but Juan, those bankers were Ivy Leaguers. You can't send those people to jail. Sam Bankman-Fried came from a pretty affluent family. And the thing is, I really do believe this, that this is one of those generational conflicts. Sam Bankman-Fried gambled with other people's money, and he's young, and he did it in techie ways. And that's why we're having such a visceral response to him, whereas the bankers were largely frat bros and stuff, but the people managing those banks are generationally older, came from a more established market of gambling with other people's money, and they had much closer ties to politicians and lawmakers and lobbyists to be able to extricate themselves from any potential fallout, any potential legal issue there. So it's again, I want to point to this and say, hey, you know, credit default and swaps and, you know, shorts on things like car loans, I feel there should be a lot more regulatory scrutiny over traditional banking, and we should go after them the same way that we went after Sam Bankman-Fried. Or we should go after them even harder because the potential for abuse is so much higher. Like, yet again, we are currently in another situation with things like home loans and auto loans that could cripple the economy again. And I feel that the institutions that profit from that kind of behavior should probably take a look at this case with crypto and say, oh, we're in an actionable position here. Huh, who'd have thunk it? Simon says Hypno. His middle name is Bankman. How can we not trust him? I love it. I love it. Well, and Brian Glaze, I would use different words, but I agree. Brian says, whenever there's potential for abuse, there should be preemptive investigation into a potential fallout. And this is why we have regulators, right? When you come out with a new gadget, you've got to get things like FCC approvals. We have a regulator that tries to anticipate potential consumer harms. And this is why we need to properly fund and allow regulators to operate in these spaces, especially when the business isn't really that difficult to understand. When you can break down the housing bubble in a movie like The Big Short, I feel our regulators could have also figured out, hey, this is probably bad, but we weren't empowering them and funding them properly and giving them the political room to operate in the space the way they should have. Moving right along, I'm going to take another drink of coffee here, just 2 seconds.
Hey, podcast listeners. I work really hard to find mutually beneficial ways to support production on my various distribution platforms. Instead of just running ads on this podcast and hoping they don't annoy you, I want to find products or services that you really will get something out of and that can help fund my production. While I do talk about some of those items in ads throughout this podcast, I've never created one easy-to-view master list of my current partnerships until now. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. If you'd like to help contribute, support production of this podcast and my various videos and reviews, head on over to somegadgetguy.com. At the top, there's going to be a link for Support Some Gadget Guy, and you can see what my current partnerships are. At the time this podcast was recorded, in addition to my Patreon, we can hook you up with a $10 voucher for shopping a new OnePlus, save 20% on some One More headphones, sign you up for Google Fi service, Amazon affiliate links, Audible, or you can grab a Mega Pickle coffee mug of your very own. Savory, delicious Mega Pickles. Head on over to somegadgetguy.com, support banner on the top right-hand side of my website, and hopefully you find something cool, something you like, while also kicking me a little extra scratch.
Speaking of tech and fallout and regulators and lawsuits, this is the story that just keeps unfolding. Apple, yet another mass lawsuit against Apple over iPhone batteries can go ahead. London Tribunal rules. This is coming by way of Reuters, but I don't have a byline on Reuters anymore, do I? Yeah, I don't know who wrote this at Reuters, and I wonder, is this like just another... Oh, reporting by Sam Tobin, editing by Sachin Ravikumar and Emilia Sithole Mataris. I have mispronounced all of your names, I'm positive. Apple on Wednesday lost a bid to block a mass London lawsuit worth up to $2 billion, which accuses the tech giant of hiding defective batteries in millions of iPhones. The lawsuit was brought by British consumer champion Justin Gutman on behalf of around 24 million iPhone users in the UK. His lawyers argued Apple concealed issues with batteries in certain models by throttling them with software updates and installed a power management tool which limited performance. This is the continued fallout of Batterygate and battery throttlegate from the iPhone. But this one is worded... The reason why I wanted to bring this one up, the wording on this one validates my argument. My argument has been, it doesn't matter that the software-hardware optimization of the iPhone made it more energy efficient. It was my argument that Apple was purposely putting undersized batteries in their devices that would start to throttle the experience right around the time someone would be looking to flip their phone on a 2-year contract. So the expected use of that iPhone battery was the bare minimum to get you through a day of use when the phone is brand new. But there was no buffer. There was no extra size. There was no extra quantity of power. And over the first 2 years of that battery, it's going to start degrade. So once it starts to get to like 85%, if you're regularly using it and charging it, once it starts to wear out, maybe you're topping it off twice a day, which is putting additional wear and tear on that battery cell. It was my assertion. I didn't have evidence to support this. It wasn't like I had, you know, the discovery of Apple corporate making these kinds of decisions, but it was my assertion that they were purposely putting together a package that would burn itself out around that 2-year time period. And the language of this lawsuit is supporting my guess as to why the iPhone battery problem was so systemically insidious. Because it wasn't just, oh, they're going to throttle your phone. Oh, new updates always make your phone run slower. This was a soup to nuts, beginning to end, from the hardware design to the software execution, Apple looking at a form of planned obsolescence to make you flip a phone more aggressively than you would need to, and not providing enough education on things like doing a battery replacement. That was only a part of this public conversation when Apple got tagged for this and they started offering less expensive battery replacements. And every member of my family that swapped the battery on their older iPhones is like, I got a brand new phone again. Well, isn't that crazy? And I feel $2 billion, not enough for the years of business practices that Apple profited from this type of abuse. Not enough. The billions and billions and billions of dollars of pure profit, even in the UK, like a $2 billion slap on the wrist. Not enough. Dave Burns wanted a libel. I said my assertion. I said it was my feeling and my guess with no actual information from the company. And I'm just pointing to the evidence that we have at hand that the battery capacity on the iPhone was inadequate to remain fully charged, and these lawsuits help validate my assertion. But I did not make a claim. Wanted a libel. I love it. So Baseball Super, do they still do the battery trick in today's phones? So, yes, on the iPhone, there is sort of a power management setting. So when you go in and you check the battery health on an iPhone, it does still throttle based on the battery health. From the iPhone 13, though, Apple magically figured out that if you put a larger battery into a laptop powerful pocket computer, the experience is just way better, especially when you're tagging those 5G radios. And I still feel like the iPhone 13 is the current high watermark of using an iPhone as a daily driver pocket communicator. You got the refined 5G radios, you got the larger battery capacities, and the chips are super, super powerful, but they didn't start getting too hot powerful like they did on the 14 Pro and now on the 15 Pro. Apple does not adequately cool their chips for the type of sustained use that they're describing with gaming and video editing and content creation and running those cameras hard. It is not difficult to get an iPhone 14 Pro to throttle on a game and deliver a poorer frame rate than an iPhone 13 Pro. So many numbers and pros. Niantic has done some pretty good reporting on that, especially from like, it was iPhone 10 to iPhone 11, that was a positive upgrade. iPhone 11 to iPhone 12 was a negative upgrade. iPhone 12 to 13, positive upgrade again. So that type of performance per watt is a tricky conversation. And for all these people, they're like, oh, the iPhone is so much more powerful, and look at this one synthetic benchmark score. Yeah, but a Snapdragon 8 Gen 2 can keep a higher sustained frame rate in a game like Genshin Impact than an iPhone 14 Pro of sort of the same generation of chips. So that still happens. But the main difference between then and now is that there is a battery health setting on your phone. And you can see the disclosed battery health and understand a little bit better that that's what's happening. I feel it was insidious of Apple to do that behind the scenes. We are slowing your phone down. We're not telling you why. It happened after an update, so you got a new version of iOS and now your phone runs clumsy. That to me was the big problem. Because they were purposely making it look like something else was the issue, which would then force you to go out and buy a new iPhone when really all you needed was a battery replacement. I really feel like we were probably near criminal charges with the way that Apple obfuscated that data from consumers. And they'll never get the comeuppance that they really deserved for making such a terrible anti-consumer business practice and how many millions and millions of consumers it affected. That one was one that I believe federal charges probably should have been brought up, or at least a much, much more aggressive federal investigation. The FTC, I think, completely dropped the ball on how to go after Apple for an anti-consumer business practice. Oh, Gabaletta. But Juan, Apple make magical phones that have unicorn magic hardware that just make everything sunshine and rainbows. A little bit, sure. Oh, Gormlord. And proper shout out, too. If you would like a YouTube channel that covers this stuff well, please support your buddy Hugh Jeffries. Gormlord says, Apple makes my blood boil every time a new Hugh Jeffries video comes out. Yeah, he does incredible work at looking at the sustainability and repairability of Apple products. And I believe it's through his consistent approach to testing repair parts on iPhones that caused iFixit to change how they grade repairability. Because iFixit has always focused just on the disassembly of hardware parts. And I believe it's because of Hugh Jeffries that they said, okay, Apple can make the phone easier to disassemble, but that means nothing if the rest of the software prevents you from replacing parts. And I think it's really, Hugh Jeffries deserves so much credit for consistently approaching that conversation. I got like J. Jonah Jameson in my head on that one, Simon. Is it libel, slander, or defamation? What did he say in the Spider-Man movie? Because I can never remember. Is libel spoken or is slander spoken? Well, it's important. I can't remember. It's such a great line, and I love J.K. Simmons. Let me get that out of the way. We've got a sensitive story, and I'm not one to do a whole bunch of trigger warnings on topics, but this is one that we are increasingly going to have to deal with as a society, and it's unsurprising to me that it manifested exactly in this way. So if you're sensitive to topics regarding the sharing and distribution of abusive content or abusive materials, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this. I'm going to point to an Ars Technica article that I really hope you will read. And I'm just going to talk a little bit about the philosophy of the problem, crouching a lot of this in language that, one, will hopefully not affect the YouTube and Twitch channels that I stream from, but then also not upset people unnecessarily. AI, and when I say this, I mean machine learning generative content. Like, this isn't artificial intelligence in the way that we talk about it in science fiction. What I mean is I write out a prompt and then it tries to make a picture of that prompt. And I can feed it information to help guide the output. Well, gross skeezy teen boys are gonna gross skeezy teen boy. And I don't think any of us are going to be shocked by the application of gross, skeezy teen boys. Written up by Ashley Bellinger over at Ars Technica, teen boys use AI to make fake nudes of classmates, sparking police probe. So here's one of the things that I really need the media. And I'm not condemning the title of this from Ars Technica, but I'm using this as an example. Teen boys use AI to make fake nudes of classmates. Okay. Immediately, the distribution of that content is using someone's likeness in an extremely aggressive way without their permission. And that is abusive. Also, the victims of this abuse are underaged. This headline probably needs to be much more severe. And the crime that's being described needs to be much more severe in the distribution of content that we're all very concerned about when we talk about CSAM. And again, I'm purposely using some of the softest language that I can to describe this. Someone who grew up watching screwball 80s comedies that have aged very, very poorly in the modern era and were all very sort of gross and really grotesque, especially in how they portrayed teenagers and the high school shenanigans of these types of interpersonal relationships between minors. When we just put out a headline that says fake nudes, I think that undersells the offense. I feel it does a disservice to the harm that something like that could cause someone at one of their most formative ages. And that this material gets distributed around a school is, I can't think of many things more humiliating than being sort of the target of a situation like this. And we're talking about teenagers, we're talking about skeezy, gross teen boys, but this is one that I feel needs to be acted on aggressively, because skeezy teen boys are dumb enough to get caught. The really horrific population of people that are taking this business model more seriously in distribution are looking at ways to not get caught. And they will have access to tools that can generate content in shocking ways. And we've got the tech bro problem. Oh, the genie's out of the bottle. Just can't do anything about it. I don't know what you can do. But AI really isn't that clever. And the way that we create this content, we need ways of flagging things like the hash data, right? So someone takes my face and they put it on something else and we all have a good laugh at my expense, but there needs to be something in the hash that says, oh, by the way, this image is the F fake, right? Down to its lowest level core in a way that the container for that data cannot be sort of overly adjusted without red flagging or manipulated without it sending up a warning sign that it is also fake. This is the type of conversation that the tech bros should have been having before they dumped these language learning models and generative AI tools out at scale. To me, it's like, again, you would have to have been a complete and total moron, like completely unable to function in society if you looked at something that can generate an image out of like a prompt and some basic data on someone's face and not think, oh, but skeezy gross teen boys are going to do this to their classmates. Like, this is such a no-brainer. And so I would like people to take a look at this Ars Technica article. I think our language surrounding this type of violation needs to be a lot more aggressive. I think we need to be putting words like abuse, abusive imagery, into the titles of these to make it the social stigma. Skeezy gross teen boy wants to do this and keep these kinds of files on their own system and they're confident they're not going to get caught by cops is one thing. But if we soften the language around it, eventually, we just acclimatize ourselves. This is just always going to be a problem. There's just nothing we can do about it. And it almost becomes that weird kind of tech bro validation of something that's kind of gross and grotesque. And so for me, it's the the request, and when people find and share these kinds of articles, that we talk about them as the abuse that they are. This is a violation of someone. This is a violation of their likeness. It's also done in a way that I believe part of the draw for someone who would do something like that is the violation. I am doing this and I'm putting their face on another body, and I know they would be upset if they found this. And that, to me, is the worst aspect of this, is getting skeezy teen boys young into getting a sick or visceral thrill out of that violation and giving them incredible tech tools to accomplish that kind of violation. So we can let that one sort of go for now. Please read the article and click through some of the links in the reports. I feel Ars Technica really does their homework in putting together the ins and outs of the situation beyond just sort of telling you, oh, this thing happened. They bring the receipts. And so I feel that helps contribute to the conversation. But I would ask, for those of us that are following these kinds of stories, that when we talk about this kind of stuff, I believe our language needs to be much more condemning and much more aggressive in pointing out from the article title that this is a form of abuse, of psychological abuse that we really should not let ever represent the tech that we try to accomplish with our gadgets and gizmos and computers. So let me take another drink of coffee here. Hold on. Oh, man, Simon, thank you so much. You kind of summed up what my rambling was. This is a really good button for that. Simon says, Hypno, quote, boys will be boys, not good enough. It's the thoughts and prayers of technology. It's like this meaningless sentiment. I completely agree. And also, it's the continued conversation about what it means to be a man. And we've allowed so much baggage to infiltrate this conversation as we try to be instructive and we try to be good role models. And it's like, I just need to take every like 12-year-old boy to like a movie theater and make them watch a whole bunch of old Gregory Peck films. Like, this is what it means to be a man, and he's honorable, and he does these things, and he sometimes has to do hard work to support his family, and I'm not going to fight you in the public square, Charlton Heston. If we have a disagreement, we can come to a meeting of the minds on our own terms. And, like, it's like we've been dealing with this idea of toxic masculinity since the end of World War II, and we didn't have a phrase for it back then for things like PTSD. We go, oh, this soldier is shell-shocked. And so it just seems like we never really do get to stick the landing on this because someone else just wants to be a douchebag. Because some guy wants to be a jerk, now suddenly we've got to be sensitive to the conversation about masculinity portraying the most toxic elements of masculinity. And it's, I don't know. I just think it's such a, I don't, a word like it's such a bummer. It's insufficient to describe how disappointed I am in how we manage some of this, because the idea of masculinity should evolve and change with every successive generation that comes up. They for themselves should be allowed to define what masculinity and femininity and the spectrum in between those two endpoints should represent. And I feel from the boomers on, and as I gotta lay some blame on like Gen X too, it's like we're so caught up in a nostalgia for a time that didn't exist that we're not like passing the torch, not through millennials and now Gen Y or Gen Z or whatever Gen Alpha comes after that. And I feel like there's going to be a slingshot effect. As the boomers properly die off, Gen Xers are going to have to make that choice. Like, what side are they standing on? Are they going to be boomer light, or are they going to get on board with millennials? And I'm sort of right on the cusp between Gen X and millennials. And I increasingly look at like, well, maybe not millennials. Maybe I need to really try and side with Gen Y or Gen Z. Because, boy, we're not getting it done. Oh, Dave Burns, like we've got to reteach lessons of empathy when we start seeing problems like this at scale with technology, we have completely lost conversations on empathy. And this is such a critical part of the conversation for tech empathy. I often wrap these podcasts talking about the thank you that I like to extend for people in this chat to take care of yourself so you can keep taking care of others. That you are the tech neighbors that you don't get, but you get to help other people because you're a fan of this stuff, you enjoy this stuff, and you dig a little bit deeper. That's all empathy. And tech empathy is so critical in this day and age where you can see the different issues that people have. You can kind of anticipate the different struggles that people might have. And you have that superpower. You enjoy talking about this stuff. So you can dig in and you can point out things they might have missed, or you can just make someone feel good about the gadget they own. You get to wake up every morning and make a decision. I meet someone new today and they have a phone, and I know everything about their phone because I actually pay attention to this stuff. I can tell them that I like a different phone better, or I can just point out all the things that are cool about their phone. I can leave that person in the single serving friendship sitting at a lunch or a cafe table and just like, oh, hey, yeah, I saw that, blah, 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 isn't that cool? Oh, yeah, doesn't it do that one thing? And then they're like, oh, yeah, it does. And they're going to forget you 5 minutes after you leave that interaction. But for that moment, you did something good and you put a smile on someone else's face. You have this superpower. And every time you leave the house, you can make that choice. So how you decide to use your power. Are you going to use your powers for the forces of awesome? You can do that. Michael Peppertech, I mean, from your keyboard to God's ears. I'm going to have to save that for a whole other video. That'll just get me all kinds of hate traffic on YouTube. You bring up a good point, but I really feel like we should try to move on and try and wrap up the news block here. But hold on. Before I shift to this next story, it's a Google story. It's a lot lighter. We don't have to worry about the heavy-handed stuff. Thank you, everybody in the chat. In this moment, I was really anxious about bringing up that story. I had very high expectations that my collection of people chatting would bring up interesting points, would contribute to the conversation, and we wouldn't have to worry overly about some kind of awkward situation about defending terrible experiences from people, or, you know, or some kind of like tolerating intolerant situations. You all were awesome. Thank you for letting me express some of my anxiety about that topic and that story. And also, yet again, another extension of a thank you to everybody in this chat, that if you ever have to broach one of those topics with people in your circles of family and friends, I feel very confident that this is the group of people who are going to have a thoughtful approach to having those conversations with other people who might be concerned, who might be anxious about talking about this kind of stuff. I very much appreciate you, and that was an incredible way to kind of get through a difficult story for me. All right. Google. Sorry, I had no transition, and my brain locked for a second, like, how do you transition out of that? There isn't one. There's been a lot of legal disclosure on Google's business practices. And again, I've got to reinforce, like Apple, like Samsung, like Google, Microsoft, these are not singular entities. These are amorphous blobs of political power entrenched in a corporation structure. And I feel, again, in this chat, we can all appreciate the little pockets of things that I think all of these companies are doing well, while also looking at maybe some of the executive leadership of these companies and saying, hey, you could be doing better. Google, especially in terms of their search and advertising business, a lot of disclosures have been coming out about how much money they have been paying companies, especially Apple, to the tune of tens and $20 billion per year to make sure that they are the default option for things like search. And this starts to really put a dent in a lot of their arguments about Google. Well, I mean, Google's the best search engine. That's why people use it. It's not that we're lazy and whatever the default is on our computer or phone or tablet just sort of stays there. And that's why Google, I mean, it's not that Google's paying Apple $20 billion to make Google search the default. It's the Google search is so good. And then you immediately follow that up, if you have a functional brain in your head, you immediately follow that up with like, well, if Google is such the de facto winner, and it's so overwhelmingly better than any other search, why would Google need to pay Apple $20 billion to make it the default search? And then you also take that extra step too, where like, Apple keeps saying they don't profit off of our user data and our behavior, but they kind of just dump a whole bucket of your user behavior and search data directly over to Google, and they get like $20 billion a year to do that. It's almost like they directly profit from selling off our user data. So, I wanted to bring this up because I find this entire market is horrifically... my assertion, not an actual legal argument or a declaration of some kind of evidence that I have gathered. But I find like we're at the edge of outright collusion, right? Apple doesn't have a search engine, even though we know Apple devs and engineers have worked on their own Spotlight style search option. But they default to using Google as their default search on products like the iPhone. That's not the legal sort of definition of collusion, but man, are we like right on the boundary or right on the edge of just pay to play and Google kind of getting their way because they can throw billions of dollars around and that this seems to benefit them, that they're a $1 trillion company in terms of market cap and stock price and all that stuff. And they can give a company like Apple $20 billion because they will make more than $20 billion with search data on iPhones. Okay, sorry, this was a really long-winded way to get into this story. This is just such an odd and galling twist on what I think is kind of an objectionable business practice. So this is written up by Ben Schoon. Is it Schoon or Schoon? I've never met Ben. I apologize, Ben. I've likely mispronounced your name twice. From 9 to 5 Google, Google uses search revenue to strong-arm Android OEMs into pushing security updates. So, this is a bad thing to do. I want to say it was about 2 years ago, we talked about some of the lawsuits Google was facing about strong-arming OEMs. Like, if you do an Android with Google Play Services phone, Google would not allow that company to make a fork of Android device. And Google was found, like, this was not a business practice that should be supported. And many courts sided with OEMs in this sort of bifurcation of, restricting the ability to fork Android and stuff like that. And again, torn on that because, oops, I said the G word and three phones on my desk just lit up. And I'm torn on that because there are some things about the consumer experience that we want to maintain, but then also it reduces competition. So that's an anti-competitive business practice. Totally get it. So if you sign on to a Google revenue share, Google says, hey, you've got to make Android look and work like this. And already that makes me a little anxious because Google has so much control over the direction of Android. But then also, without that revenue share, a lot of these OEMs would not be updating their phones at all. You want the new update, you got to buy a new phone. And so it's like the worst kinds of wrong, Google being able to dictate what the software experience should be, Google paying money to make sure that when you open your phone, these default services are the first things that are kind of in your face, and that makes consumers... we know consumers are reluctant to find or use any alternatives to seek out other options. But then all of that comes down to, oh, and by the way, if you want the money from installing our services and making them the defaults, you also have to update your devices. And you're like, oh, but I like that part. But I do want that. And I don't feel we've ever properly valued software support on phones. I it's acid in my mouth because I'm not a fan of Samsung, but one of the reasons why a Samsung device might cost a little more, outside of all the lawsuits that they have to fund their legal team to fight, and their other really terrible anti-competitive business practices, are some of those promises that you will get some extra software support and attention, even for some of the mid-ranger devices out there in your Galaxy A series. And again, we saw price hikes on Pixels, but getting a couple extra years of software support comes at some kind of price. Getting a couple extra years of hardware component support, where repair parts are guaranteed to be in the ecosystem out to 7 years, means you've got to front load that price. And there's only a $100 price hike going from a Pixel 7 Pro to a Pixel 8 Pro. I get that. But this one to me was just like a funny immediate conflict in my brain of, I don't like anything that the YouTube and the Google search teams are doing in ratcheting content, using algorithms to affect user behavior, making us miserable so we spend more time on their sites and services, and then paying companies to be the default options for services and search. But if that's how we're getting updates, you can see why I'm conflicted about that. So please check out the rest of the article from 9to5 Google, just because it's just such a weird time that tech has raced well past our regulators' ability to manage these types of business shenanigans. And we have so much catching up to do on what is like the legal limit. What is the definition? Where are the boundaries for a company like Google to operate in this space like this? And also, where are the conflicts? They make their own phone, and they have access to data and information. They're making their own hardware. I mean, like, this is starting to get sensitive in how we define and break up the duties of the different components within a massive corporate conglomerate like Google. It's not enough that they changed their name to Alphabet and they have a whole bunch of little mini divisions. I feel like there needs to be more regulatory scrutiny over how all of those divisions interoperate and how they do business with other companies outside of the Alphabet umbrella. And McCorcoran, I'm totally with you. I think the problem is we've shown time and time and time again, consumers stopped letting that be. I'm sorry, let me read McCorcoran's comment here. It's a shame there is no way to like pay extra to opt into longer security patches if you have a phone that's outliving its end of life. Like my Pixel 4a and LG V60 have like 88 and 94% battery health respectively. I don't want to give them up. And I really want to say, I mean, it's like since the days of like the classic cat named Mac OS build and the well, I would say, like, was it Windows Vista? No, Windows 8 had retail packaging, didn't it? You could go to a store and buy a boxed copy with a disc in it of an operating system. But increasingly, I think these corporations sort of saw within that time frame that we would be releasing a major update or some major new version of an operating system. We can instead dovetail that with around the time a consumer might be pressured into buying a new gadget to run that on. And that to me is the massive disappointment is, you know, I've been playing with mini PCs. I've been playing with some older phones that are still screamers. Like if you've got a Snapdragon 845, that is still a laptop powerful chip in your pocket. And there's no reason why it couldn't be supporting current software today. If we can come out with 700 series and 600 series Snapdragon phones today, then there's nothing holding a Snapdragon 845 back except for the agreements between the OEM and Qualcomm and the sort of capitalistic market pressure of getting people to flip their phones. Those consumers are likely more facing battery degradation than any type of underperformance from the SoC. The SoC is perfectly capable. So I'm kind of with you there. It's really a bummer, but if consumers don't pay for it, then it's a project that fails and it falls apart really quickly. So what Google did instead was we just built the extra cost directly into the upfront purchase price. And I feel that's what more companies need to do, and then make a bigger deal into year four, year five, year six of support, saying, hey, by the way, those of you, you know, still rocking your classic Pixel 8 Pro, we're with you. Here's this new update. They need to make more noise about that in marketing. And unfortunately, that means for this to be a benefit that consumers really appreciate, we won't see the effects of that for another 5 years from today, if we're going to change consumer behavior on valuing things like software support. So, we've got one more little news story here. Again, this podcast not brought to you by Ars Technica, but kind of all the stories I want to talk about were covered on Ars Technica. We talked about this a couple months ago, that there was yet another exploit on iPhones as in regards to wireless radios, especially Bluetooth. And wouldn't you know it, I got one person sent me a message on Twitter saying, like, I make way too big a deal out of stuff like this. Oh, you're just an Apple hater, was essentially, I don't remember exactly what the argument was, because as soon as someone pushes back on something like that, I kind of eject that data from my brain. But it seems like someone has found a way to use a little piece of hardware to exploit that little gap in Apple's Bluetooth security. And there's a tiny little device called the Flipper. I've seen these things around. Like, I've seen YouTube videos about these. I have not played with one. I'm not very familiar with one. But what this thing can do is it can mimic being an Apple TV, and it sends out just this burst of connection requests that will cause an iPhone to, well, first it starts spamming the iPhone with connection requests that people have to swipe away as individual notifications, because iPhone notifications still suck bad compared to Android notifications, which are much, much better. But then eventually it causes the phone to lock up and reboot. And it's doing this at scale where you can just sort of put it out in a public space, and it's affecting numerous devices within range of the radio. So over on Mastodon, I don't know how to pronounce his name, Jeroen Venderham. This is weird. On the train and my mobile Apple devices are rebooting, showing a possible connection to an Apple TV beforehand. And then I look around and notice I'm not the only one. I turned on lockdown mode, and even then it's showing the same alert and crashing. And so when we point these things out, it's not me just patting myself on the back for not buying Apple gear and going, Apple dumb. There are actual real security implications of examining the marketing claims of a company that talks all about privacy and all about security and then leaves massive gaping holes in some of this structure. That's how we fix these problems. And I'm really tired of people that push back on this idea, like, we shouldn't talk about it or make a big deal out of it because Apple will fix it and patch it. Well, how do you know? How does Apple know to fix or patch something unless you bring up this situation? And now, if someone wants to be a little malicious, they could go buy this Flipper thing, especially now that it's kind of gotten broadcast out and it's getting a little bit more news on outlets like Ars Technica. I totally see some kid or someone who's just wanting to, you know, sort of mess up someone's day walking around with one of these little Flipper devices, just knowing that, like, hey, on the bus, everyone's iPhone is going to be rebooting. Ha ha ha. Isn't it so funny? I'm at my kid's school and all of the parents, their phones are having issues. Like, that's the kind of like daily shenanigan chaos that you can cause when Apple isn't on top of this type of security. Now, the Flipper can also be programmed and it can be operated to cause similar issues on Android devices that have notifications on for things like nearby share. What we haven't seen yet is the barrage of notifications affecting an Android device to the point of rebooting. That one I haven't seen demonstrated yet. In following up on this article, just trying to see, like, is it exactly the same? So far it seems
Like, it will slow your phone down, and it's just annoying to constantly have pop-ups that a device is trying to send you something. But it doesn't seem, if you've got, like, full open, if you've partially restricted nearby share, it doesn't seem like it's the exact same kind of problem that we have with Apple's solution of using Bluetooth for these services. And again, if Apple wanted to contribute to the Bluetooth special interest group, they would have an entire consortium of people that would help alleviate some of these issues. Apple would not only just be benefiting from all of the work from these other companies, they'd be able to contribute and guide the direction of future iterations of Bluetooth. But Apple never wants to contribute, so the experience for iPhone owners is worse. Apple never wants to be a part of this standards and practices conversation anymore. They only want the proprietary option. So you pay more for an iPhone to have a poorer experience when these types of situations arise.
Just a quick interjection here, folks. I love highlighting good work and talented people, producers and writers who deserve more attention. So here's a quick word from someone making cool stuff on the internet, and I hope you check out what they have to offer.
Do you like podcasts about tech?
Oh, yeah.
Do you like podcasts about tech where you... See, I already f***ed it up. that's okay, because I don't want to stop the recording because then we got to redo it all. So I'll just put it there. Do you like podcasts?
Yeah.
Do you like podcasts about tech?
Hell yeah.
Do you like podcasts about tech that have your favorite creators like Juan Carlos Bagnell, TK Bay, and many, many more?
Oh, yeah.
Well, if you do, you should check out the Nomad Tech Project with Sam and Joe. It's a podcast about everything tech and sport and food and getting to know your favorite creators from the back end. Like, you know, you could watch their podcast and hear what they have to say about tech, but where did they go to high school? What did they like to do before they became a podcaster or a tech creator or a YouTuber or a Twitch streamer? Check us out. We're on every Sunday from 3 p.m. Central, 9 p.m. BST in the UK.
Ish.
We'd love to have you. Maybe throw a sub and tell your friends about it. Again, Nomad Tech Project with Sam and Joe on your favorite podcast aggregators. Take care. Love your faces. Be excellent to each other. We'll see you on the show.
Goodbye.
Yeah, it's pretty gross. I don't want to be that guy, but I kind of want to see, like, what is a Flipper Zero? Is this going to be sort of the asymmetrical warfare that we see in Gadget Land? I don't know. Gormlord, do people just leave nearby share on all the time? There are a surprising number of Pixels at my daughter's school. One of my daughter's best friend's mom, she uses a Pixel 5. Two of the administrators have Pixel 6s. I think they're Pixel 6s. And then there's another mom that just got the Pixel 7 Pro. She loves it. I have tried to share photos with Pixel owners. None of them have been aware of nearby share. Like, there's almost no awareness. I share photos with my wife. My wife still has not returned my Xperia 1 Mark IV. There are videos that I actually kind of want to follow up on with some of the updates that are coming out on Xperias. And I can't because my wife is using it as her daily and she's not giving it back. The experiment was, use this, see if you like it, and then if an Xperia 5 comes out, we can switch you to that. But no Xperia 5 has shipped, so I think my Xperia 1 is just gonna be her phone. If I ever share something directly to her, I have to handle her phone and turn nearby share back on and get it to connect. So in terms of the severity of the exploit, the Apple version is worse. In terms of the social impact of this, the Apple version is way worse because so little education has been brought to Android consumers on how to use nearby share. For once, the Android side of this equation, the security through obscurity, is actually working in our favor. It almost never plays out that way. But just the fact that no one knows about nearby share is making this a little bit better if someone wants to try the exact same kind of attack with a Bluetooth broadcaster on a little flipper. It's so
funny. I leave Nearby Share on all of my phones all the time because I am constantly moving files back and forth between different review devices. I am absolutely atypical in that regard. Yeah. Brian Glaze, unexpected win. For me, it's a task fails successfully kind of situation. We want you to use Nearby Share. You don't know about Nearby Share, so you're not going to be hurt by this Bluetooth problem. All right, it's 10:26 in the AM. We got to talk a little MediaTek. I am really excited, but also a little anxious about MediaTek's big announcement this week. The press embargo, the reveal, all the information is now available. And that's that we have a new chip, a new premium tier chip coming from the MediaTek team. This is the Dimensity 9300. And I really enjoy this. I love doing their little pre-briefs and stuff because they sent out the 9200 last year. So I have a little Dimensity 9200. I'm just going to keep collecting these as long as they'll keep sending them to me. But now we have the little Dimensity 9300. It's in this little plastic acrylic case. I just dropped it on my chair. And you got this cute little chip that you can like hold for your videos and stuff. It says MediaTek Dimensity 9300 on it. And then I went through on the back of the chip and I counted all the little solder points and connectors and stuff. And, you know, it's billions of transistors. It took me all weekend to count out all of the... It's such a dumb joke. I'm sorry. I couldn't even keep going with that. So this is fun because MediaTek is playing with their marketing and playing with their branding. This is big news because MediaTek is doing something really unconventional with their chip design. And from where we were last year, Qualcomm and MediaTek had very similar overall chip designs, core configurations. There were some differences between some of the medium-sized cores, but we kind of arrived at a very similar solution from the 9000 to the 9200. We arrived at some very similar solutions between Qualcomm and MediaTek chips. This year is going to be very different in how all of these chips are built. So we just got a really early peek at performance from Xiaomi. The Xiaomi 14 Pro was launched in China. A number of people have imported it. I am so far behind on other reviews. And like, I haven't gotten a camera review out in a couple months. And I do apologize to folks on the Patreon because I've got a backlog of phones that are going to start arriving on the Patreon now that the releases have kind of slowed down a little bit. But short story longer than you needed it to be. Qualcomm changed up their small core configuration. So a Snapdragon 8 Gen 3 is still a one big primary core, but then they got rid of two of the little teeny power efficiency cores. So it's a different makeup, it's a different configuration. MediaTek is getting rid of all of the little cores. So it's still an 8-core SoC, an 8-core CPU, I should say, but it's four of the really big Cortex cores and four of what we call the medium-sized cores and none of the little mini cores. So I've got the MediaTek page up right now. I can screen share some of this. This is just like their sort of press release page on what the chip is going to do. But they're talking a 15% single-core performance upgrade and a 40% multi-core performance upgrade over the last year's chip. But this is the breakdown that we're really kind of anxious about. We've got four Cortex X4 and four A720s. And again, this is yet another step where, from the hardware level, MediaTek has also walked away from 32-bit compatibility, or this is a 64-bit chip, 64-bit components, and there's nothing to really fall back on. So I did a pre-brief with the MediaTek folks, and we had a conversation just about these are all the new specs and these are all the cool things. And the CPU configuration for me was one of the most important things to focus on because I am a little anxious. It's built on TSMC's third generation 4-nanometer process. So we don't get the benefit of a die shrink. So we're not going to maximize power efficiency through a new fabrication technique or a die shrink. According to the folks at MediaTek, their current configuration, when operated at the same performance as the Dimensity 9200, is significantly more power efficient than the 9200. We've heard claims like this before in the past. And you've heard me say things like, I don't know that we really need yet another generation's improvement. Like if I go back to the MediaTek page here, okay, cool. 40% more multi-core performance, but that's not 40% more multi-core performance at the same power draw as the 9200. If you let the 9300 draw more power than the 9200, it can do a lot more work, 40% more work. But now I'm a little anxious that that kind of performance and that kind of spread is going to nuke a phone battery like a Snapdragon 8 Gen 1 could nuke your phone battery. So MediaTek, we're in this conversation. Sorry, I went off on a little tangent there. We're in this conversation, and I brought that up specifically. Like, what are some of the guidelines? How are you testing some of these claims? What are you doing to engage in this kind of? How do you deliver this kind of metric? And when they bring up things like, okay, we can actually maximize this type of performance, and it means less power draw. One of the things that they were pointing to were the little phone interactions. We know a lot of people on their phones like to watch streaming media. If you're just kind of scanning through TikTok, we can do this at a 30%, multi-core power reduction over the 9200. And that's cool. For those little brief phone interactions, it actually makes a lot of sense to go bigger core, because you're going to crunch up that information a lot faster. The CPU spikes to a higher power utilization, but then it recovers so much quicker. And if you offload that to a low power core, like one of those little mini cores, it could take your phone a lot longer to finish the same computational task. So you could end up using more power by going with a lower power core. I'm speaking so generally and broadly, and if those of you who are actually into the silicon industry, I'm sorry, because I know that this is like low-level explanation of how some of this stuff works. I'm oversimplifying to a pretty high degree. But my question for them was, well, how do we start talking about things like more sustained performance? How do we talk about things like, if you want to cut up a little video of your daughter's Dia de los Muertos celebration at her school, are those four huge cores and four medium-sized cores going to run hotter or kill my battery faster? I did most of the editing for that video while I was shooting those clips on the Pixel 8 Pro. That, to me, is like one of the most exciting things that you can do with a phone. At the very beginning of the celebration, I recorded a whole song from the Mariachi. So it's like a two and a half minute clip. And I dumped that into LumaFusion, and then I would shoot a little snippet and I would drop it directly into the timeline. Excuse me, a good coffee burp there. I would drop it immediately into the timeline in LumaFusion, and then when I got home, I just kind of cleaned up some of the transitions and I did like a slow motion effect on a couple of the clips. If I'm doing that sustained over, we were there for about 2 hours. The Pixel 8 Pro handled it okay, but I took a good chunk out of that phone's battery. If I'm shooting and editing on a phone with a Dimensity 9300 and those four big cores and four medium-sized cores are really lighting up to help me scrub through my video timeline and to arrange those clips and to record and to offload, is that something that's going to... am I going to really have a screaming hot device that's just melting its battery? Or is it really accomplishing those tasks in a more efficient fashion? And will I get a power savings out of that? And they, no one really has answers to those questions because we don't have devices to test yet. So that to me was the big concern. A lot of this other stuff is stuff that we were kind of expecting in this generation of chip. Let me go through here too. They've got, so precise control over power efficiency, up to 33% multi-core power savings over the previous generation CPU. And that's where they were pulling out those graphs saying like, hey, in sort of this kind of use, if we could use the chip the same as the 9200, you would see the significant power reduction. And I would really love to have some kind of sit down or conversation with OEMs and say, hey, give me sort of a two generation old performance mode, and we would have just an incredibly power efficient chip. If I could use this phone the same way that I was using a Snapdragon 865, we could be looking at like a 40% power reduction over the 865, which was a really great chip for battery longevity. And I feel if you go to all of your circles of family and friends and say, hey, do you want 30% more performance, or would you like 40% more battery life, but your phone performs about the same as the phone that you currently have that's 2 or 3 years old? I feel most of the people in our circles would say, give me the battery life. And you would still have a crazy high performance chip. You would still have an incredible pocket computer ready to go. But, you know, my LG V60 was 2 days of use under my use. If I could add 40% more battery life to what I could do on the Snapdragon 865, that's a 3-day chip. I would have a 3-day phone with my kind of use on a phone. Really heavy, lots of messaging, lots of audio, screen off time, tons of camera, a little bit of video editing and mixing, lots of social media. That is a brutal compute load to put a phone through over 2 days. I could add a whole extra day. Sorry, let me just kind of get back to some of this MediaTek stuff because I think it's really interesting. The big claims were on the AI hardware. MediaTek's next generation APU architecture incorporates a hardware generative AI engine, enabling faster and safer edge AI computing. So I need to get more familiar with some of these claims. Like, so up to 33 billion parameters. I am not qualified to describe what that looks like in any kind of practical sense. I am at a point where I barely grasp why we use some of this language to describe the performance of generative AI systems. But one of the other things that they brought out when they started talking about peak parameters and memory compression technologies, one of the things that really impacts AI performance is RAM. So when we start seeing these little bubbles, these little claims like, oh, the next OnePlus might have 24 gigabytes of RAM, I really think a big chunk of that is the OEM has some designs or some ideas of better leveraging the AI hardware. So if a OnePlus 12 comes out, and a lot of the claims from OnePlus are, oh, you can do this LLM, you can do this language prompt thing, you can generate content out of it, you can make this stuff, not having enough RAM significantly degrades the AI compute performance that's built into the chip. MediaTek broke down some numbers. I'm going to have to wait until I get a phone in my hand with a Dimensity 9300 to kind of better evaluate what they're talking about. But one of that thing, when they're talking about 33 billion parameters, or you can do this and like so many billion parameters at this level of RAM. And then they started showing slides saying, oh, but if you go to 16 gigabytes of RAM, this improves the performance of this, and that can pull back. If you would like to future-proof and you start looking at another 50% increase to the quantity of RAM, then our chip can better communicate with this. It's not going to be as fast. It's going to slow down the operations per second, but you can achieve this kind of output. So that, to me, is also the hilariousness of the market right now is really AI-focused. Generative AI, language learning models, like, they're really, this is really the big hype. And shareholders and investors get real twitchy when you don't talk up a whole bunch of AI in whatever product or service it is or platform that you're trying to create. But to me, it still seems like language learning models and generative AI take an inordinate amount of power to produce the content that they make. We make the joke about Microsoft executives were investigating building their own nuclear reactor to power their ability to generate AI hardware. But energy concerns are a thing. GPU performance is a thing. And now we're going to be overbuilding the phone in our pocket to support the more seamless presentation of AI. So what does that mean? That means 24 gigs of RAM on a OnePlus 12 to spit out this generative AI content. The 24 gigs of RAM aren't going to do much for you at all in every other aspect of owning a premium tier phone. We're adding 50% more RAM than we need for the operation of the phone at the highest levels of gaming performance, of video rendering and content creation performance, the main ways that you can brutally tax a smartphone. We need to add 50% more RAM than that just so the AI doesn't look pokey. Just so that the AI is like, if you give it a wacky prompt to, I would like you to draw a picture of a Tyrannosaurus head on a chipmunk's body. And for that, I need 8 extra gig of RAM that the rest of my phone won't ever touch in high-level operation compute tasks. And that, to me, is our priorities are a bit out of whack. Gormlord, but what about my AnTuTu scores? Oh, it's so crazy. Well, let me take a drink of coffee here.
The SGGQA podcast is brought to you in part by Me Audio. So here's the deal. If you've ever seen me in a live stream or in an interview or some other kind of video, you've probably seen me wearing some fancy earbuds. For the last couple years, my work buds have been almost exclusively from Me Audio. Excellent drivers, fantastic accessories, and both my wife and I had our ears scanned by the folks at Me Audio for custom molded ear tips. Super comfy. The MX line of Pro in-ear monitors is one of the easiest lineups to understand, starting at $60 and built around actual professional use. Detailed sound and durable construction, but also with some fun options like customizable faceplates. Even if you're not working on stage or in studio, Pro solutions like these are fantastic audio options, and they don't need to break the bank. And the company also supports a lineup of consumer gear with options for true wireless and noise-canceling Bluetooth earbuds, adapters for TVs to stream your audio to nicer headphones, and headsets for kids to help control the volume on fresh, developing ears. I can't stress that last one enough. We have to start kids out with healthier listening habits. It's a great combo, high-quality audio gear built by a team of folks with recording-grade use in mind, but at consumer-friendly prices. But of course, I can do you one better. If you shop the kit at meaudio.com and use promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout, you can save an additional 10% over their already competitive prices. Once again, meaudio.com, meaudio.com. Shop some fun kit, promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout, 10% off. Keep your ears and your wallet happy at the same time. I want to thank the folks at Me Audio for hooking up the promo code. Now, let's get on with the show.
So I got a little insight on some of this coming by way of MediaTek. The other thing that I really wish I could show you a little bit better, I reached out directly And unfortunately, just because this is like their big announcement, they didn't have any information to share coming back. We also have some new news on the GPU. We're going up to a 12 core. I believe the 9200 used an 11 core GPU. I might have that wrong. Someone please correct me in the chat. But we're doubling a lot of the performance metrics and the performance per watt metrics. But one of the biggest is, again, we're still making this claim. There's a 46% improvement in hardware ray tracing performance. Okay, I'm going to ask in earnest here. I am very interested in seeing the impact or the effect of ray tracing on mobile games. I genuinely do not know of any Android games that support hardware ray tracing. I've seen demos. I've seen pre-rendered graphics clips. I've seen benchmarks. I need a game that I can play and shoot video of to show people this is what it looks like. When we started doing that on PCs, you know, we go back to like the RTX 2080 days, there was some interesting conversation about the performance trade-offs of utilizing this kind of hardware to make a game a little prettier. Anything we can get. And so I've reached out to the folks at MediaTek, and they said they'll get back to me, and they've actually been really communicative on some of these other topics that we've covered in the past. So I hope they will, but there is no guide. There is no list that I can point to. And I know there are a couple games in China, but even then, is there a way that I could get an APK to install this on a test phone? I don't expect consumers to ever do what I would describe, but I am the person who would like to test these claims and to show the impact, because once we have that conversation, it might make Western developers more interested in adding a switch or a toggle or something like, hey, we want these other lighting effects or volumetric or the ability to generate frames, right? We saw there was the announcement AMD might be working with Samsung, not on an AMD GPU, but bringing FSR tech to Android phones. And if we start playing with generative and upscaling technologies on mobile, that really helps squish AAA and really beefy, meaty console and PC games onto our phones a little bit better. We see Apple has been doing some work in that regard, where you can play Resident Evil on an iPhone. Like, that's kind of a big deal. We could extend some of that out to developers right now, but if there's no conversation about this at all, and nothing that I can demonstrate from the Dimensity 9200 that launched this year, technically at the end of last year, but it was actually shipping in phones at the beginning of this year, I can't show people that. I need to be able to show someone, oh, by the way, this is what it does. The GPU is so much more powerful now, we can do something like upscale or do an FSR-style trick to better interpolate. There's like a setting on Vivo and on Xiaomi phones, where I believe it is a type of frame generation technology that helps try to smooth out gameplay without actually rendering every frame. For Vivo, it was attached to their coprocessor, which was also responsible for their screen management and their camera performance. And on Xiaomi, I don't know that it's a coprocessor, but it is buried in the gaming settings that, like, you can kind of optimize the gameplay and set it to 60 frames per second, but it's not really. Like, if the game can report its own frame rate, you're seeing like 30 frames per second, but then the phone is saying, oh no, we're totally delivering 60 frame per second gameplay. So I'll have to save that, and I am hoping that they will deliver some titles or talk about some developers who might be interested in doing some of this. Gabaletta, yeah, this is exactly what I ran into. To my knowledge, there's only a handful of games that are China exclusive, and that's fine. I would like to be able to show what that looks like, if it contributes to the gameplay. Does it seriously harm the frame rates? Does it make it harder to play? that's something I would like to investigate. And unfortunately, I have never been able to get a list. This also happened to us when we went to 120 frame per second screens. I have my Razer Phone 2, and Razer put out a list of titles that were compatible with their display, and that was awesome. And then we got a kind of a trickle of other, like, oh, and these phones support 120 hertz, and these phones support 120 hertz screen tech, and these games can be played. And then it was like all of that just disappeared. And now when I go to play games on a modern spec, crazy powerful Snapdragon 8 Gen 2, Dimensity 9200, most of the games just lock out at 60 frames per second, if not 30. I know there are ways that I can, like, crack into some of the settings on Alien Isolation. Alien Isolation, like, hard caps at, like, 35 frames per second. Like, I really haven't been able to push a phone past that with all of these different pro power modes, battery settings, anything else. But someone has said, like, hey, if you can get in there, you can tweak this file. But I think I might need to have a rooted phone to do it. And I just haven't been messing with rooting phones at all. Sorry, that was really long-winded. Yeah, see, I mean, this is what I'm saying. Gormlord, I've only seen GeekerOne do it on Genshin, and he had to pretty much hook it up to an AC unit to keep it from combusting. I did see the GeekerOne example of that, but it's still like, why, you're selling me on high refresh rate displays. There are games that could be running at these higher refreshes, and they do look nicer. If you care about that, you'd care that your game is being displayed. Dead Cells looks really good above 60 frames per second. A precision platformer, that's actually kind of nice, where it's more fluid and your interactions are more precise and it's sharper and it's crisper and it's cleaner. It's a really pretty experience. Riptide, the racing game Riptide, can hit higher frame rates. But then beyond that, there's no good consistent list or reference for people to try to see the perks of these upgraded SoCs and these new GPU and CPU performance claims. Oh, Sparta's saying I don't have to. Okay, so you don't have to root it. I've done it on my Xperia 1 Mark III and it was beautiful. Okay, you want to tell me, like, how? I've tried looking up, like, how do I unlock high frame rate on Alien Isolation on Android? And let me tell you, that Google search does not go well for you. Oh, see, like, okay. Who said, like, Colonel Corn Pop, chess at 100 frames per second. And you know what? I would play that chess game. I bet it looks pretty good. Gabaletta, Vampire Survivors is great at the beginning of the run at 120 hertz. It's only been on the most recent builds of Vampire Survivors that my Steam Deck can survive keeping 60 frames per second pretty much running through the end run on a round of Vampire Survivors. Android phones have been doing that since it went to mobile. I mean, like a Snapdragon 888, not difficult keeping pinned higher frame rates than what my Steam Deck could do. So let me just kind of wrap up Dimensity. And then speaking of gaming, I also do want to share just a couple little thoughts on a game I've actually been playing. We've got the Imagic 990, a new ISP for sort of some higher tier performance for AI analysis of our images. So not just can it spit out a JPEG or an MP4 faster, but supporting new camera sensors with 100% pixel level autofocus, a new plugin for OIS. So now the SoC has a camera component that directly handles image stabilization that the phone manufacturers can use. So it doesn't have to be a separate coprocessor or another part of the chip, which, whether or not all of their claims about, well, this is the absolute best image stabilization, it should also help reduce some of the camera power draw when you're moving your camera around and you're trying to stabilize an image.
And then even better analysis of, again, using AI, using these machine learning components, even better subject and depth detection. So as you're shooting someone, like say you want to use a cinematic mode, a super software fake bokeh mode, the AI hardware can better define subjects in your video, and it does a better job of estimating depth. So what I'm hoping is that this is a generation where we see another step of improvement in bokeh fall off, focus fall off. Because I hate fake software blur. It sort of isolates the subject, and then just everything behind the subject is sort of uniformly blurred. I know Samsung does this a little bit better than others. Apple Cinema Mode does this a little bit, where it's trying to give you the look of focus fall off, but we're years away from this looking like an actual lens optical effect. But again, this would be the next step, is can we identify this? And then if the AI can also identify trees and things in the background, it should have better information to say, this tree should be blurrier than that tree, which is farther away. And we can start sort of falling the focus off from your subject in a more pleasant way. So, I mean, the rest of this is just like a lot of conversation about improved video processing and better support for new types of displays, low power modes, better discrete, dedicated display options, or ways to combat burn-in. And then it doesn't seem like there's any kind of radical change up for the wireless tech. So a lot of our stuff like Wi-Fi 7, I think Bluetooth 5.3, I don't know that they really listed. It just says MediaTek Bluetooth and hybrid coexistence. So like mitigating the signal broadcasting from Wi-Fi and Bluetooth. But a lot of this is just sort of refining and a little bit better global support, carrier support for different radio bands. But that's often a thing that's kind of up to the phone manufacturer for activating parts of the chip to better support some of that stuff. So, yeah, this is a very different conversation in terms of how this chip is made. And so Qualcomm is going for a one big core, a whole bunch of medium-sized cores, and only two power efficiency cores. MediaTek says they can get rid of the power efficient CPU cores, that they have a big medium solution, not a big medium small solution. And I was very impressed with the Dimensity 9000. The Dimensity 9000 was so much better than the Snapdragon 8 Gen 1. The Snapdragon 8 Gen 2 was a huge improvement, and I would say it kind of outpaced the Dimensity 9200 in a lot of our sort of head-to-head performance showdowns, but the Dimensity 9200 was still a phenomenal chip. Like, I've used it on a Vivo, and I've used it on a Xiaomi. It is such a great daily driver, power-efficient kind of chip. I'm a little worried that in chasing the biggest AN22 score, MediaTek might be making the mistake that Qualcomm and Samsung made with the 8 Gen 1. Chasing a small burst of activity at the highest AN22 and the highest Geekbench scores looks really cool on paper, but if the phone built around that chip doesn't properly cool it, doesn't get heat out of the phone case away from the SoC, if it's not a balanced device for all that kind of longer-term workloads, then we end up with a chip that spikes in performance and then throttles because it runs too hot. So I'm very anxious to test these claims when an actual device arrives. I'm hoping it's like a Vivo. I really liked using the Vivo X90 to test the 9200. I'm kind of hoping it's the same, where you can say, like, oh, here's a Vivo X100 with all these new camera sensors and stuff. How much does this really play out? I'm really hoping that that's what we see either the end of this year or early into next year as a shipping device. As a device making it out to actual consumers out there. So I just got to take a quick pause here. We can switch gears and talk about some RoboCop. But one Mr. El Jefe Reviews, Jeff, subscribed at Tier 1 on the Twitch, supporting this podcast. Thank you so much. Currently subscribed for 51 months, and that means you get the new Juan's Crazy Mediocre Soundboard of Glory fanfare for you supporting the website and the podcast and all of the content that we make here. Thank you so much, Jeff. I really appreciate it. That's awesome of you. And again, I always love seeing your face popping up in the chat and hanging out and chatting about some cool audio gear and stuff. Everybody should be following El Jefe Reviews because he's the one that kind of got me back into Bluetooth audio a couple years ago. He's pretty hardcore. So we're technically at 2 hours, so we don't need to spend a lot of time on this. I just want to wrap this up because it was just sort of a singularly unique and nostalgic experience. I don't share a lot of my video game playing with folks on my channels because gaming is supposed to be fun, and I don't want to turn yet another one of my hobbies and passions into another side hustle. So when I was at Newegg, if they wanted to produce gaming content, I could show up and talk about it. It was great. I didn't have to make all of that from soup to nuts on my own. I mention gaming a lot, but that's one of the reasons why I focus so much on productivity for my mobile reviews, is because that's how I really use my mobile products. Fun party at my daughter's school, I shot a video out of that, and that's how I live my life, is I'm not sending a dozen little video clips to people. I'm squishing it all down in that moment to make one little video event that is easier for people to consume. So I did a goofy stream, a really silly stream, a couple days ago on here on the Twitch. And I tried playing RoboCop Rogue City on my Steam Deck. And boy howdy, does RoboCop Rogue City not play at all on a Steam Deck right now. It was pretty bad. You can go back through my Twitch and catch some of the video replay. I'm not going to spend a lot of time here talking about that right now, because it was absolutely not the way to experience or play that game. But for me, it was just the silliness of, this is a new game. It is some pretty meaty system requirements. It's causing some consoles to sort of struggle a little bit. And also, it's just like we're kind of pushing into the next generation of game engines. And so RoboCop is kind of an interesting property to examine some of that. Where, just kind of going back into screen share here, and if I do the launch trailer, oh no, let me mute it. I'm going to try and get this up on the screen so we can kind of look at it a little bit better. The game engine is really delicious. I'm playing this now mostly on my beefy workstation. It's a Threadripper 2970 with a 2080 Ti, right? My system's a little older, a little long in the tooth, but it's doing a good job of keeping up with 1440p and I've capped it at 60 frames per second. But doing all the lighting effects and the destructibility of the environment and the look and feel, there's so much production design that goes into this game, that if you're a dude like me who was kind of raised on really violent, hyper-violent 80s action films, it looks and feels like the third movie that we should have gotten for a RoboCop. The look of your HUD, the way that you analyze information, the objects that you can pick up in the environment, how you interact with the environment, everything has that kind of destructible feel to it. The character models are spot on from the first two films, like the old man from OCP and the police chief in Old Detroit. the voice actors don't sound anything like those characters, but the models look spot on. And then RoboCop is voiced by Peter Weller. So Peter Weller is getting up there in age. The voice performance is a little on the softer side, but it sounds right. It looks like RoboCop. It sounds like RoboCop. And as you're moving and controlling this in that first-person shooter perspective, it feels like RoboCop. One of the things that's kind of funny, though, is the difference between video gaming exposition and the way that movies handle editing and dialogue. You will get into a cutscene, and in RoboCop the movie, everything is really chaotic. This is a dangerous world. This is a crime-riddled environment. RoboCop is kind of an authoritarian-style Ubermensch kind of character. An Ubermann kind of character, where he's got these like really simple directives to serve the public trust and enforce the law, and he's kind of a judge and jury in a Judge Dredd kind of way in every situation that he stomps into. And the RoboCop movies, I think, do a really good job of satirizing that 80s Reagan era consumerism and crime conversation, where we were so concerned about the liberals letting murderers out onto the streets because they cared more about criminals' rights than the victims. And all of that was nonsense, but it was really effective political discourse. In RoboCop the movie, and in RoboCop 1 and 2, there's constant activity and chaos. Like, OCP guys are talking over each other, and there's kind of an excitement and an energy, because that's what we do with movies. And it's kind of this buzz of activity and this buzz of information. Every scene has to have purpose, and people step on each other, and it gets kind of messy, but that frenetic energy is kind of what makes even the expository parts of RoboCop an exciting film. Wow, does video game dialogue just take forever to get through? So you do, like, you go through this initial hostage situation and you kind of clear it out, and then you have to report to the police station, and that's where, you know, like, they've got to make sure you're functional because you took like a bomb to the face. And so you go to the shooting gallery and you have to show that you're proficient. And then one of the little mini side quests is you've got to help the desk agent get through more people. There's like a long line of people that have complaints. And so you actually have to go up to the desk and talk to people. And like, that's a little mini side quest. And one of them, the memeable one, is a woman comes up and is like, oh, and I can't find my son, and it's been 2 days and he's missing. And you can decide to help her or not. And when RoboCop helps her, he types something out on a computer, and then he's like, I'm sorry to inform you, but your son is dead. And she's like, oh, I'm so sad. And then, like, in the most cynical fashion, achievement accomplished pops up on your screen. So many people have already been making fun of that moment, but in the movie, that would have been edited into a really tight sequence that would have shown, like, Alex Murphy is still struggling with the dichotomy of his being. Is he a machine? Is he a police officer robot? Or is he still a human that can show empathy and concern for others? And that at the beginning of the film, that would have been shown as a way to highlight his mechanical nature. And by the end of the movie, he would have rediscovered some of his humanity. But it would have been a really condensed sequence. In the video game, you have to help three people, and the last one is this woman who's looking for her son, and the dialogue is the slowest shot reverse shot. I have accomplished my speech, and this is the last point I am trying to make, period. Camera cuts to the other person. What you've said is very interesting, but I also have this other problem. Are you going to help me out with it, RoboCop? Question mark. Shot reverses. That is not something that I am able to help you with in this moment. And you're just like, get on with it. Go faster. And it's the fundamental issue with like video game dialogue, explaining everything out, making sure the player has all the information they need to accomplish the next task. But at the same time, it's like, this is RoboCop. And it feels so much like a RoboCop movie, except for the way that you get information is so ponderous. Excuse me. Oh man, that was a terrible coffee burp there. I'd buy that for a dollar, Simon says Hypno. Yeah, Jeff, and I'm less critical of some of these other properties. So Jeff's comment, let me read that first. Agreed, Starfield and Red Dead Redemption 2 dialogue goes on and on. I know it's part of the immersion, but I read far faster than the characters talk. And characters don't talk like that in any other media. Red Dead Redemption 2, for me, is the perfect example of so many delicious little attentions to detail, except that's not how I consider my environment. In Red Dead Redemption 2, they do these beautiful transitions. Like, you open a drawer and you see the hand go to the drawer and open it, and then you get the things out of the drawer, and then you can see, was there anything in that drawer that you want? I don't think about looking at my hand as I go to open a pantry door or a drawer in my cabinet to then go in and look at these things. And it's like we focused on the wrong aspects of simulating real life. Now, Red Dead Redemption 2 is an amazing game. I'm not saying that that makes the game unplayable. To me, it's the weird distraction of what would you really be considering in that movement if we're simulating real life? I think it's actually more appropriate to just have the drawer magically open. Because we don't think about how our hands work to open a drawer. But in the context of something like Starfield or Red Dead Redemption 2, I don't have the 80s movie nerd emotional baggage of knowing what a RoboCop movie looks and feels like. Red Dead Redemption 2 actually kind of gets away with it because my experience with my favorite Westerns, those are really long movies that have lots of sequences of quiet. What about a movie like Unforgiven? The turning point in Unforgiven is as simple as someone drinking whiskey from a bottle. And there's no big fanfare, there's no big explosion, there's no big music stab, there's not like a close-up or anything like that. We have invested 2 hours of our life following this character, and he takes a pull from a bottle, and you're like, oh no, oh, it's about to get real bad. And I think Red Dead Redemption does a good job of playing with time and space like that. RoboCop is 80s cocaine-fueled, high-energy, high-octane. RoboCop is crazy television commercials interspliced between tabloid, awful journalism and moments of like wacky people saying things to camera, and then it cuts away to this. The opening sequence in RoboCop Rogue City is making fun of those TV broadcasts from the movie. I got really excited. But it starts out, you give us a minute and we'll give you the world. And then the anchor comes on to talk about the new updates and the new news stories and the criminals that are ravaging Detroit. In this next topic, we'll also talk about this and this. And isn't that kind of a funny thing, Sheila? Ha 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 ha, you are correct. That is a funny thing. And you're like, in the movie, it would have been 3 times faster. Because that's how hyped up we are on tabloid journalism. That's how hyped up we are on like cable news and graphics and interviews that come flying into your face and these graphics and stuff. That's not a part of Red Dead Redemption 2, right? That's not a part of the classic Western aesthetic, pastiche. That's what RoboCop is. So unfortunately, everything about the look and feel of the game feels like RoboCop, except for how people talk to each other. And I do feel that this is another game that kind of falls into that same trap of urgency, where you get your briefing at the police station. There's this big thing happening at the arcade, and there are tons of these criminals, and we've got to find out who this new crime boss is. Also, a side quest, one of the other officers has not reported for duty for 2 days. So we've got a missing police officer, and we've got all these new criminals in town. Robo, go hit the arcade, go see what's going on. And the second you get out of your car, you are distracted by a myriad number of little side quests. But there's no ticking clock urgency on finding the police officer or determining who the new crime boss is, because you've also got to help this shopkeeper, you know, not get harassed by these street thugs that play their music too loud. Or I ran into an officer arresting a drug seller, and that sends you off on another mini quest to find out who his supplier is. But isn't there an urgency to finding the missing police officer? Isn't that something we'd want to accomplish tonight above these little XP quests that give you, you know, experience points that you can level up your armor or make your combat skills more proficient? So again, there's that in the movie, if the quest was, there's a missing police officer, we got to go find him, the movie then wouldn't divert RoboCop to, like, stopping someone from spray painting, tagging the side of a building. Right? The movie isn't going to take time to have you chase that guy down. He's hiding in a dumpster and you have to use your scanning visor to find the flecks of paint that were tracked by his shoes so that he could jump into. That's a cool video game mechanic. But in the back of my brain, I'm still going, but don't I need to go to the arcade and go find this guy who's, like, maybe killed a police officer? Like, isn't that kind of more important right now? I know I can ignore the side quests, but then they just kind of keep stacking or I fail them. And I want that XP so that I can improve my skill tree and I can get more, you know, armor and weapon upgrades for RoboCop. So I've been playing it for, I'm about 10 hours in now. I really like it. And there's so much to love about the trappings of retro-futuristic OCP and old Detroit. Because it looks like it came out of the 80s. The design on Ed 209 is still exactly the same. All of the characters, suits, the whole environment is 1980s street thugs and Wall Street tycoons. The weaponry is from the movies. One of the first missions is you got to recover the mayor's daughter's car. And it's that really weird 80s futuristic sports car, the SUX. So all of that is, like, every single thing is just so lovingly inspired from the movies and from sort of the RoboCop mythos, the RoboCop canon. There isn't anything in here that I feel is going to be incredibly exciting for fans of first-person shooters. Like, if you're really into different game mechanics, like, it's RoboCop. When you push shift to have RoboCop run, you're at kind of the same walking speed as a lot of other first-person shooters. He is a tank. And you go into every combat situation knowing that you're going to soak a whole bunch of damage. And so the gameplay is a little slower than a lot of our more, especially if you're into, like, battle royale first-person shooter or any kind of competitive shooter kind of gameplay. But there's not a lot of, like, run, jump, dodge. There's no cover mechanic. He literally just walks into open space, and the best you can hope for is, oh, if I round this corner, I can kind of back up and have enemies come to me, and then I can take them out. But there is no, like, dive, cover, sprint, burst-style RoboCop. There is, like, a dash that you can unlock where he kind of surges and it becomes more of, like, a melee attack. But that's not the same as, like, good cover mechanics or other types of first-person shooter gaming mechanics. So there's not going to be anything there that really lights up the first-person shooter aficionado. It's a pretty basic skill tree that you unlock different abilities. You can get better at cracking open safes or unlocking lockers. Or instead, you can build up his armor so he can take more damage. Or you can make his attacks more effective, especially for critical shots. All of that's pretty standard. Really, you get this game because you kind of want to live in that world, the movie world of that old Detroit from the RoboCop films. And like, again, RoboCop is one of those incredible movie properties. The first two movies I love. I just unabashedly adore the hyper-violence and the satire and the comedy. And a lot of that still remains. A lot of that is still here in the game. So if you want the unofficial third RoboCop movie that we should have gotten, that's why Rogue City is maybe something you should take a look at. If you're looking at a more sort of expressive use of this game engine and you want to play with exciting new game mechanics, you're probably going to get bored. This is probably not what you're going to be into. But I got an actual guffaw. The game actually made me laugh. I catch a kid tagging the side of the building. Kid goes running off. I scan the spray paint and I can follow his footprints, doing like a magical 1980s style chemical analysis, all from an optical scan of the spray paint. And I find that he's hiding in a dumpster and I pull him out of the dumpster. I get this ponderous dialogue exchange between him and me. And I eventually decide, okay, I'm going to write him a ticket. I'm doing my job as authority cop here in Old Detroit. And so I could have let him off with a warning, and that would have been serving the public trust. So that's also the other thing, is you can kind of guide RoboCop's reputation. And so most of what I've been doing has been serving the public trust. I'm letting people off with warnings for the street punks harassing the shop owner. I didn't smash their radio, but I threatened them with grievous bodily harm. All of that has been great. I finally get to this one kid and you're like, if you hadn't run away and made me chase you into this dumpster, I would have let you off with a warning. But now this is technically two infractions. This was evading police capture and vandalism. So I write him a ticket and he's like, I'm gonna tell everybody about what's going on with you, Robo. And he goes running off and I get the mission conclusion. You have made an enemy out of the street tagger. Just like, oh no, it's going to come back to me later on in the game that this 13-year-old street tagger is now my enemy. I have made an enemy out of the street tagger. So moments like that are hilarious. RoboCop not really rising to the occasion to show empathy or humanity when you tell a woman that her son is dead. They're dark funny. There's some really silly sequences in how the game plays out. So RoboCop Rogue City, I'm probably going to try and roll credits on it over this next week. I'm spending a lot of time going through these side quests, and I really should just focus on kind of completing the main story campaign. But it's a pretty easy recommend for fans of the film. In much the same way that, like, you know, we got a really great Ghostbusters game that became sort of the unofficial third movie in that 80s franchise. RoboCop 3, the movie, is terrible. And RoboCop, the TV show, was sort of awkward for its depiction of violence. It doesn't feel like RoboCop in the TV show. Even though there are some interesting storylines in the RoboCop TV show, it's not the same. It doesn't look or feel the same as the movies. So you kind of don't put it in the same category. But RoboCop Rogue City, the game, kind of takes you back to just how brutally violent RoboCop 1 and 2 are. So it's a lot of fun. Hold on. Let me wrap up these comments and then we can kind of get out of here. Kenox 80, that's not too far off with the neoliberalism now. Yeah, those commentaries all kind of cycle on each other, don't they? Sorry, I saw another one. LFA reviews. It's almost like if we're modeling these transitions after Zuckerberg behavior. I know video gaming has this challenge. You need to get the information to the player, but honestly, like, I don't know that any game has really done it better than Half-Life, where expository information is delivered to the player and the player can just choose to walk away in-engine. Like, I remember just really viscerally in Half-Life 2 Episode 1, there's this whole conversation happening and I realized I missed the entire thing because I was walking away and looking at something else in one of the labs. And I, do I want to reset the moment? No, I can figure it out. It's fine. And I made that choice as the player in that moment to just sort of be fine with missing an entire dialogue situation. And that's the kind of stuff I wish we had just a little bit more agency over, where the game grabs your head and pulls RoboCop out of a first-person perspective into a third-person view, and then it is the most ponderous, shot, reverse shot, shot, reverse shot. Conversation and dialogue
is so slow.
That's the kind of stuff I wish we could kind of switch up. Yeah, Colonel Corn Pop, the OCP police armor was OP until the plot says it isn't. Oh, poor Murphy. Notice, like, he got shot in a whole bunch of places where there wasn't that crazy OCP police armor. Michael Corcoran, I tried to find RoboCop to stream the other day. I ended up on Roku watching some failed television show, some spinoff that took me 10 minutes to realize it wasn't the right thing. RoboCop is one of those, I think they just recently did another Blu-ray re-release. The original RoboCop Blu-ray is terrible. So if you can find the more recently distributed RoboCop Blu-ray, it's really good. The cleanup is a lot better, especially with these new like 4K transfers that they're going back on some of these films. It's one that, you know, like, I've got my list, my shelf of Blu-rays up there behind me over my right shoulder. That was one that I just put. It's like, I don't ever want to have to look for RoboCop. I don't ever want to have to look for The Omen or Die Hard. These are movies that are yearly watches for me. My wife and I enjoy them. I want them just in my collection, and I maybe found a way to transfer the movie off of the Blu-ray onto my NAS. But I bought the movie. Like, I own the disc. I'm not letting go of the disc. I will forever always try to keep the best version of that movie that I can find. So RoboCop for me was one of them that I just absolutely had to keep. LFA Reviews, you just started the Taggers villain arc. As I just turned him into a super villain. I totally did, Jeff. I wrote him a citation. That's all it took. For the Joker, it was falling into a vat of acid. For this Tagger, it was getting pulled out of a dumpster and written a $100 ticket. Oh, man. Colonel Corn Pop, what is your... Sorry, there it is. What is your opinion on the 2014 reboot? You know what? The 2014 RoboCop reboot is sort of a fine, functional action sci-fi movie. And I think they did an okay job of modernizing some of the satire. Like, the Samuel L. Jackson character is a very good representation of today's commentary, podcast-style commentary on politics, where the news reports in the original RoboCop kind of fit what the 80s version of that commentary looked like. I think you just get to the end of that movie and it doesn't hit the same way. So Paul Verhoeven with RoboCop, and he's done this in a couple of his films, uses violence as a way to satirize violence in media, and he takes it to such an extreme. I think part of the point is you're supposed to be a little shocked at your own enjoyment of a hyper-violent movie. But unfortunately, what that does is it also raises the threshold for depicting violence in movies. There's another movie, Funny Games, that is a direct criticism of violence in movies by making one of the most disturbingly violent movies of its era. But then you watch that movie and you kind of desensitize to that level of violence, and you sort of expect a higher level of violence. The Saw films, for me, fit that problem also, where the first Saw film is kind of quaint by comparison to later Saw films in the horrificness of that kind of torture depicted in a movie. So the new RoboCop feels bland because I don't feel they dug into sort of the body horror of becoming a machine. And I think they kind of let off that conflict in the RoboCop storyline. The movie itself is kind of a fine action romp. You get that thing where he gets to the end and he's got to try and betray the OCP, you know, programming, and what does it mean to be a man or a person? Can he kind of achieve this? Can he kind of resolve this conflict? It just doesn't hit. It just doesn't have the same kind of bite. It doesn't have the same kind of edge. And even for the original RoboCop being so 1980s, and a lot of parts of the original RoboCop don't age well from a society conversation standpoint because it is a product of its era, I still feel the original RoboCop still kind of bites a little bit harder. It kind of hits a little bit harder because they're going for that hard R rating in an age of 1980s films where hard R was a lot more brutal than today. Today, we're trying to blur the lines between rated R and rated PG-13 and making PG-13 movies more brutal so that they don't get the R rating, but we can still play with violence in our films, like The Dark Knight. That should really be a rated R film. That should be a rated R Batman movie. A guy gets a pencil through the eye, you set another guy on fire, there are scenes of urban terrorism throughout Gotham. There's no reason that movie should be PG-13. But we didn't say a naughty F-bomb word, and we didn't really show a lot of blood. So we kind of squeaked by with a PG-13. And that doesn't work for me. Canox 80. I am getting to that point of the year where I've got to start showing it off. Die Hard, A Christmas Story. Die Hard is one of the best Christmas movies ever made, and I'm not saying that ironically. So I have a video, and we're going to start promoting this video again. It's 11 minutes long. I'm going to pull it up here on the YouTubes, and I'm going to mute it so that it... Will you just show me the thumbnail? Yes, perfect. Okay. So I am unabashedly and unapologetically putting up Die Hard as one of the best Christmas movies ever made. It talks about family and relationships in a way that satisfies the criteria of a Christmas movie. It deals with a character's regret, which satisfies the criteria of a Christmas movie. And it is one of the most impressive 80s female characters that has ever been presented on screen. So we've got Sigourney Weaver in Aliens, and Alien in Aliens. We've got Linda Hamilton in The Terminator. Holly Gennaro in Die Hard is the third place 80s action female character. She is one of the most capable and clever characters ever written and ever shot on film, but she is subtly injected into the plot to be capable, and the ending of the film depends on Holly Gennaro. So if you go to theyoutube.com and you go to Some Gadget Guy's channel, you will find a video from 2 years ago called Die Hard is a Christmas Movie, Let's Put This Debate to Rest. And it's an 11-minute examination of Die Hard and why it is a fantastic Christmas movie. I will die on that hill. That is my line in the sand. It is one of my all-time favorite films just in general, but it represents all the things that we say we care about in holiday films. We have holiday ghost stories, and spirits are supposed to spook you at the end of the year. A Christmas Carol is a Christmas movie, and it deals with someone's lifelong regret. It examines the impacts of their actions and all the people that they've hurt, and it's carried through this ghastly interpretation of history and future events through the telling of ghost stories. That's a Christmas film. If you can have a Christmas ghost movie, why can't you have a Christmas action movie? As long as it's fulfilling that criteria of dealing with family and examining regrets and examining sort of the year, and you come to these conclusions at the end of the year. Christmas is that time where we really self-reflect. We start coming up with New Year's resolutions after we've done our examination of the year before us. Die Hard absolutely fits all of that criteria. LFA reviews, Juan will fight you over Die Hard. I don't know. Do we need to do another movie watch along? I know we did one last year. Are we going to make the annual viewing of Die Hard the thing that we do on the Patreon? Let me know, because I'll do it. Like, we get through Thanksgiving, then maybe the first movie we need to do as a movie watch along is Die Hard. Because it is. It's the best. We've got to watch it every year. Baseball Super, you got me. Oh, man. It's so good. Oh, yeah, El Jefe Reviews. Alan Rickman's American accent still cracks me up to this day. Do you remember his name? Bill Clay. I went to one of those ranches where they shot, where they shoot the guns with the little balls of paint. Because he looked at the roster and he saw that one of the offices was used by a William Clay. So he introduces himself to John McClane as Bill Clay and puts on a great, I'm sort of Western, but not, American accent. Awesome. Just brilliant. Oh, the movie is so good. It's so good. Every little scene has just a delightful little purpose to it. And you get to the end and it's one of the best marriage love stories where the two characters are working their conflict out in the middle of a hostage situation. If you're on the surface, you're going to hype up like, oh, well, it's sort of the bromance between these two cops. But no, the story is intrinsically linked by Holly and John McClane's marriage. The entire movie is their marital issues being worked out in the middle of a hostage situation. I love it. I love it. It's so good. Oh, in Sparta, I put the alien isolation frames per second instructions in the Discord, which means I've got to wrap this podcast up so I can get to my private Discord, which you can find on the Patreon, patreon.com/somegadgetguy. And now there is a resource. I'm going to check out how I can improve my gameplay, Alien Isolation on Android, and hopefully bump up that frame rate and see if that's something that I can communicate to other people in an effective fashion. Because some of this stuff I get real nerdy about, but then I can't really explain what I'm doing very well. So, folks, we are running headlong into... Discord is still down for some of us. Oh, that's a bummer, too. I mean, I've been kind of popping back and forth, but I haven't seen anything come in from the Discord, so you're right. I might be down, too. And T-Bubs is saying, also, we got to remember to check out Elfster. I'm going to check out Elfster and see if that's something that our family can use as a secret Santa guide, just so that we can kind of ease up some of our gift giving. But that's the point I kind of want to wrap up on, is we're running headlong into the holiday season. I am still, like, I just got another flurry of press emails on new home crate batteries, solar cells. There's a new drone that's coming out. Obviously, MediaTek is going to be making a lot more noise about what phones are going to be using their new Dimensity 9300 chip. We've got the 8 Gen 2 out. Rumors that Samsung might try to nudge up the launch of the next generation of Galaxy phones. We're kind of caught in this cycle where we're accelerating the spend on every generation of new tech. I've been showing off mini PCs. We've been talking about folding phones. I got some new headphones to review. It's ever more critical that we're balancing right tool for the right job, broaching these conversations so people have better resources to help guide a purchasing decision when they decide they want to buy something. And then also, I feel like this is the right time to take a step back and talk about things like, how do you get more use? How do you get a better bang for buck out of your purchase? You got this really cool, new, exciting new phone for the holidays. What else can you do with it? Does it just replace your old phone? That's boring. You could have just kept your old phone. What's new? What can you really do to push the boundaries on that and really get your money's worth? But then above and beyond that, just the other opportunities we can take to have technology help expand on other experiences. If it's travel, if it's art, if it's content, if it's creation, printing out photos. Your phone camera is so good. Do some large format prints. And you don't have to worry about having the printer at home. Like, you can go to a drugstore, bring a little memory card of photos from your phone, and they'll print some big photos for you of things that you shot from your phone. You can make that thing, and you don't need to feel held back because you didn't use a real camera to take that shot. So increasingly, as we get through the end of the year, I'm probably not going to be hitting gift guides very hard. I never have. I'm just not good at keeping track of all that stuff. But I will share some better sales. Like, there are a couple device manufacturers that are probably going to be doing some real good sales for Black Friday. I'll probably share more of that stuff over on Threads if you want to catch that. But I just really love taking this opportunity to kind of open up this conversation and share some of this stuff, because I think that's where this stuff gets really fun. Go use this tech to augment another experience or an adventure or travel or just a night out with someone you care about to go eat at your favorite restaurant. All of these things kind of go hand in hand with sharing that experience. So going to be back here next week. Another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. Got a lot that we're going to be digging into next week too, with some of the stuff that's coming out this week. There's a lot of stuff coming to the channel, and I'm also hosting things too. Like a friend of mine from high school is a high school teacher, and I'm joining her class to talk about hearing health in one of her psychology classes. So there's a lot. I'm going to be talking about a lot of stuff over this next week. Folks, I want you to take care of yourself so you can continue taking care of others to be the best tech neighbor and tech citizen I know you can be. I'll catch you back here next week for another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. Be safe. Take care. I love y'all. I'll catch you back.
Recording voiceover, spoken word, is truly one of my favorite activities. My second favorite hobby is photography. Now, the smartphone might be making us deaf, but we can't deny the awesome power of the phone as a platform for photography and multimedia creation. If you've been looking to improve your mobile photog skills, if you want to produce more professional content, or you're just looking to take your family photos to the next level, I wrote a book to help you out with that. Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs, is available on Amazon Kindle. Walking through the basic terminology of photography, covering the settings on your camera, discussing composition and inspiration, and I even include a long list of exercises and challenges to really hone your skills, all with some helpful example photos and diagrams. Search for Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs on Amazon, or use the quick link bit.ly/betterphotosbook to grab your copy today.